I'd like to convene the Finance Committee. We do have a quorum present, and just a bit of an announcement as we move forward. I don't know if there will be many today, but we've had a lot of amendments coming in the very morning of the meeting, and I haven't had a 24-hour rule, nor do I intend to, like a committee like this, to be somewhat flexible. Having said that, though, I would request, to the degree possible, that those amendments be brought down in advance. It helps the staff, and I think it helps us, too, if we get the amendments in the packets so that we're prepared for the meeting. And we've just had simply a growing number of amendments coming down the very morning of the meeting. And so I would make that request so that we can continue to remain flexible when need be. With that, we do have the minutes from our previous meeting. Representative Kahn, have you had a chance to review them?
Yes, and I would so move them.
Okay, Representative Kahn moves approval of the minutes for April the 15th, 2008. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The first bill up then is House File 934, Representative Clark. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 934 be recommended pass. And I do have be referred to, what is the committee on Ways and Means?
Recommended pass and be referred to the committee on Ways and Means?
Right.
Okay.
And I do
you can speak a little closer to the mic. I'm having trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do have before a read all amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have an amendment.
And it's number DE8.
Would you care to move the amendment?
I'd like to move the amendment, and we'll put the bill in a the form I'd like it to go out of this committee. And basically, what I can tell you about that amendment is that unless we put it on, we had a very huge fiscal impact from the amendment that was put on a previous committee, and this cuts that way down. And the fiscal note, I think, is in the packet. It cuts it down from I think it was a couple hundred thousand dollars a year down to a half-time position. So it's much more acceptable to the committee and to the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, if we could put that amendment on, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Representative Clark, I move the amendment to put the bill in the form she'd like to present it. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Mr. Chairman, remember, just very briefly, this bill's been through a number of committees, and there's a couple of handouts that are going around. Basically, what it does is adds to legislation that we passed last year, we phased out two of the toxic flame retardants. And President Mahoney was putting up here on page one, I need to be really clear that where there's a line in 1.7, that's just renumbering the bill, it's not changing the law. We have those two exemptions for penta and octafenol ethers, big way to say toxic flame retardants that are being used in a number of products. And we don't change that at all. Those are already in effect in this country and around the world, and Minnesota certainly. What we did last year is we left one of them on the table that we researched and called DECA, and we asked the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to do a study and come back and make some recommendations. And they did look at the study, did do a study, and this bill basically reflects that they did find that DECA is toxic. It does debrominate, it does break down into these two very very toxic other forms. And so what this bill says is that by 2010, we would not be manufacturing, processing, or distributing in commerce in several areas in products that have this toxic DECA in them. And that's the exterior casing of television computers, computer monitors, and upholstery frames and textiles, and mattresses and mattress pads. Other products that have them in are exempt. And we do allow those retailers who have these products in use to exhaust their supplies without any penalty. And we do provide for an exemption in case there is some producer that finds this a hardship they can apply for an exemption, and that is why there's a half-time position at the agency. I don't know if there's any further discussion from members. The bill just provides for participation in clearinghouse. I might point out that this this compound jacket is now been in Europe effective as of June 2008. It just happened a few weeks ago that they actually made the final decision on that. Since there is a couple of documents that you should have received in addition to documents from Healthy Legacy, there's a letter of support for phasing this out from the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and the International Firefighters. We're not in any way trying to compromise our safety. In fact, we feel this makes it much safer from a public health standpoint, and there are alternatives as well to this flame retardant. So we're talking about really helping preserve people's lives from a very persistent, toxic product that's out there in their environment, and that's for which there are many alternatives. Ms. Kenner, I'd ask for support for the bill.
Any discussion, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned just briefly, President Clark, alternatives to this these concerns here, and I'm just wondering what are they? Do you have a list of them?
Representative Anderson, I have a list of them, but I know that there have been a number of them tested, and some of what can be done and what the firefighters have seen in their letters too is that they're even redesigned a product that makes them less flammable. There's different ones that are being used and that are being used in the European Union, and I think we're just trying to follow the examples of those countries and our own manufacturers who are using alternatives already.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Clark, could you give me a list, give me some names, even though you might not have the list, can you give me examples right off the top of your head what they are?
Just a minute, I might need a little help, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, I'm just wondering, I don't know a lot about this toxin, I guess you would call it. Do you have any scientific studies or anything that we could read so that I could have a better understanding of what the scientific data is behind this before we vote on the this on the floor?
Mr. Chairman, I could refer you to our own Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's document. We also have letters of support. I guess we didn't pass them all out from the Minnesota Public Health Association, American Public Health Association, Minnesota Medical Association, others who've studied this. And if you want actually a list of the studies, I guess we can get them to you. There are certainly there have been many studies on this done over the period of time. This is banned already in Europe. I mean, the scientific basis is there. It's very strong. The question that we had, I think, maybe you were, I don't know if you were in any of the committees before, was that the question, does DECA break down into the admittedly extremely toxic other two products, DECA, Penta, and Octa? There was some disagreement by that, or question about that, by the folks who were opposing this bill. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency weighed in on that very heavily and said, of course it breaks down. The firefighters know that it breaks down. It's a chemical process that we know breaks down into very toxic ones. And so
I just was wondering if there's somewhere where I could read about it, or it's on there. I can go on the website, or where can I get it?
Yes, it is on the website, Mr. Chairman, and it's called the Dexabromodifenyl Ether, a report to the Minnesota Legislature, January 15, 2008.
Thank you.
And I just was given that, Representative Anderson, if you want to know, one of the products is RDP, which is used by some Minnesota manufacturers, and it does not cause the toxic problems that the products do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, RUP, what is it?
RDP.
REP?
RDP. It stands for dispersional bisphenyl phosphate. And it's used in housing for TVs and other electronics, consumer electronic products.
That's the only one that you have?
That's the one I have some information on right here. There are others, again, I believe, in the PCA report, if you want to look at that.
Any further discussions, questions? Seeing none, then Representative Clark renews her motion that House File 934, the third engrossment, be, as amended, would be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. And we now have House File 4189, Representative Dabney.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members.
By the way, on this one, before we start, we may, if necessary, have comments from the city of St. Paul and the city of Minneapolis. Generally, the testimony is taken in division. In this case, the bill has not been in division. So if you'd like them to make brief comments in addition to your presentations, that would be fine.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I might have a point of personal privilege in the committee.
Yeah, maybe with Rep. Tim Mahoney.
Well, I just wanted to wish you a happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's
you've got a good memory, and that enhances the chance that your bill will pass.
And there's cake after the end of this committee.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Thank you.
Oh, did I blow it? I think I just did from the look on your staff's face.
Way to go.
Yeah, you know, it's
well,
been one of those
that bill will pass.
Do you want to move the bill? Mr. Chair, I'd like to, if I might, I'd like to move House File 4189 to be recommended to pass in place on the General Register. And Mr. Chair, is this the appropriate time to ask to put the amendment on, or do we have to?
If that's the way you want to present the bill,
would like
yes.
To, I'd like to move. if it's been passed out, I'd like to move the amendment, the A1 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us, and just put the bill in the form that you want to present it. So any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, briefly, over the years, the state has participated or not in the purchase or construction of a number of convention and event facilities in the state's two largest cities, often with little or no state coordination or assistance. These facilities are key business and tourism venues that generate opportunities for businesses who act as vendors in these facilities and are key tourism attractions, keeping Minnesota on the national and even international radar. Unfortunately, insufficient state support and the lack of adequate planning and development in the establishment of these facilities has created a situation where they are increasingly a burden on the local community, on the host communities, general funds, and taxpayers. Looking forward, we also need to anticipate the future needs of these event centers and convention centers and the need to maintain them as key resources for Minnesota's economy and place in the nation. This legislation asks the two central cities to study these facilities and, with the amendment that was offered today, their impact on the regional economy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, St. Paul and Minneapolis and their event centers are similar and have similar challenges. Although St. Paul's arrived sooner, this July 1st, and many versus next year for Minneapolis, this bill is a step for both cities to work together as partners, not challenge each other as rivals, which we've had that problem with our event centers, and we're trying to get around that and move beyond that. This is a vehicle for further talks about how we in the Capitol and both cities, here at the Capitol and in both cities, can talk to each other and work together to solve this common problem we have.
Mr. Chair, with us today we have Mr. Pat Bourne from the City of Minneapolis and Ms. Anna Mulholland from the City of St. Paul. If you would be interested in testimony as to the finances, they are far better qualified
than us. But prior to that, Mr. Chair, if I might, would I be able to amend my motions to pass to the general register and move it to taxes?
You must have anticipated the conversation I was just having with the tax chair. And yes,
you know, she's got this aura. When she moves around, you keep your eyes on her.
That's right. And we'll restate the motion before it passes, but so everybody understands that it will be re-referred to taxes. There's a question of our tax chair, Representative Lincheski. The question was raised about what is the tax implication of the bill. So,
Representative
Rukavina,
I
remember
I read the bill yesterday. The study, unless it's been changed, is a report on the revenue, which is the tax.
Representative Rukavina, is it? Welcome. I'm not sure which one of you is going first, so.
Mr. Chair, I'm Pat Warren. I'm the Minneapolis City Financial Officer. We certainly Minneapolis welcomes the legislature's participation in this discussion that St. Paul and Minneapolis have been having for the last several years about our what we will call maybe our public assembly facilities. Both cities bear financial responsibility, significant financial responsibility for both funding and operating these four public assembly facilities. They're critically important to both of our cities. We compete against each other and with each other, but we also know how important these facilities are to our cities and our region. And so for that reason, and because we know Minneapolis has had its own share of financial stresses related to our facilities, the two cities have begun a conversation to determine how we can collectively work together in this to deal with the financial responsibilities and stresses that we both have. So we welcome this bill's discussion with us in how to resolve and meet our obligations.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, there's no appropriation or for this bill, what they would expect a study like this to cost, if anything, or I assume they'll absorb it with internal staff, but could they give us an idea of an estimate?
Good morning, Dean Atouris, last speaking.
Sure, I'll speak just for Minneapolis. I think the information called for in this bill is information that Minneapolis readily has. I don't anticipate we would spend outside money for the collection of the information that you've asked for.
Mr. Chair, the cost a few thousand dollars or?
Mr. Chair, remember, I would say it's all staff time and existing resources that we would be using. I don't have an estimate of the value of staff time that would be necessary to do this, but it's well within our ability to produce this information and to make recommendations to you.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. maybe this is for the members of the President Dabney and Mahoney. Did this go through local government?
Mr. Chair, President Anderson, no, it did not. I believe we had a conversation with local government, and as it was just introduced the other day, you need to come here.
Just, if you notice, it just came in on the 14th.
So, I understand. That's why I'm just concerned about why I didn't go to local government.
And be beyond their deadline. Let's hear from St. Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Mulholland. I'm Deputy Mayor for the City of St. Paul. Thank you so much for having us here today. The City of St. Paul, like Minneapolis, is encouraged by this kind of this piece of legislation and thinks it's very important. There are a lot of needs within these assembly facilities and a lot of wants in moving them forward, and they benefit not only the cities, but the regions in the state of Minnesota, and we are thrilled to see the state's interest in that. It will go a long way in addressing long-term issues. However, the city of St. Paul has been at the legislature this year talking a lot about our short-term issues, and I was hoping to use this as an opportunity to share with all of you a little bit about what those short-term issues are. This bill, although addresses those long-term issues, does not address the short-term needs of the city of St. Paul. Our challenge is quite simply put in that the operating revenues that the River Center has is going into paying down our bonds and paying down debt. That is a very difficult competitive situation to be in for the River Center, and is putting us in with an extraordinary long-term challenge. So we were up here last year talking with all of you about those concerns, and are up here again this year. One of the sources that we've looked at to resolve the issue is an extension of a TIF district that expires in June. And so we do have some immediate needs as well. But we're here today to say that this bill is important, and we support it, and would love for it to move forward.
Okay, and Representative Severson, you were next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I'm just kind of curious. I know, you know, we have a five-city area up in Sauk Rapids, Sartell, St. Cloud, Wake Park. And this looks like a joint get-together. Let's take a look at our budgets and see what's transpiring. Is the end game here that we take a look and see what the shortfall is on the budgets here and then have the Minnesota taxpayer jump in here to subsidize this? Or can you give me a little long-term intent?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think at least for the City of St. Paul's perspective, our long-term and short-term intent is stability for the event district, a district that brings an extraordinary amount of economic impact to the city, to the region, and to the state of Minnesota. 4.5 million people visit our event center every year, generating an extraordinary amount of economic impact. We want to extend that. We want to grow that. We believe that's our job and our mission. And to do that, we need to stabilize the funding stream. Our competitors around the country, which are, again, River Center's competitors around the country, have very different models where they are able to put operating dollars into maintenance, into marketing, and into growing their districts. Our operating dollars are paying down bonds, so it's virtually impossible to move the district forward. So that is our long-term intent, quite frankly, is to grow and improve that event district every day so that it continues to perform for the City of St. Paul, for the region, and the state of Minnesota.
Representative Peterson. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, how does this upcoming looks like a final deal with Northwest and Delta going to affect the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul? Is that going to be part of your study?
Mr. Bourne, looks like you're the one, or Representative Mahoney, whoever.
I think the legislature gets to direct that, and at this particular stage of the discussions, that's not part of it at this point in time. It may eventually grow to that, but today, no.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think it's a great question. I don't think we have any answers for it right now. It's a question I think that's on the minds of all of us, and we'd love to be able to answer that, but I agree. It may not be within our ability or scope to be able to give you an answer that any of us would have much confidence in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I do believe that if you're going to look long term, looking at your financial stream and your economic development and economic stability, that's going to have a major impact on bringing people in, and that's going to affect you, I think, in a negative way.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none then, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 4189 be recommended to pass and as amended and re-referred to the Tax Committee. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, just
Mahoney.
Symbolism, we had the St. Paul people sitting with the Minneapolis legislator and the Minneapolis person sitting with the St. Paul. This is a problem.
But I noticed St. Paul had Minneapolis outnumbered 2-1, but the third person didn't get a chance to comment. but was available, I assume, for questions, so thank you for being
here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We'll now go down to House File 3587 by Representative Solberg and Representative Hahn.
I've moved the division report on 3587, the State Government Finance Division report, the first committee we've got.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 3587, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and place on the general register. And
Representative Solberg, there is an amendment here. I don't know if Representative Simon, is that the way you want to present the bill or wait?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Representative Simon move that amendment, the delete everything amendment, and he can help explain it as well. It's been a combination of several bills that were heard in Representative Kahn's committee. One was passed forward, and we've just done some good talking this last yesterday, and so maybe Representative Simon can present the amendment.
And this is the way you want to present the bill. So
that's
we'll
correct.
View it as a motion by Representative Simon that puts the bill in the order that the author would like for presentation. Representative Simon? Thank you. Staff says it's being passed out right now.
It is being passed out.
Okay. Well, then I will move the DE1 amendment, although if you'd like me to wait until it's fully passed out. We won't vote on it until it's fully passed out, but if you want to begin explaining it,
sure.
Because it is fairly lengthy. So the motion is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The DE1 amendment, as Representative Solberg already alluded to, is a compilation of a few bills that have already received a hearing, in fact, in Representative Pawlowski's committee, and then were referred, they were recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee, but may or may not, depending on the case, have gotten a hearing in Representative Kahn's committee, but they've been before us in the Finance Committee for a number of days or weeks. And so why don't I just go through the sections of the DE amendment and just very briefly explain where they came from. And incidentally, this is the product of a working group that got together through the interim and through the beginning part of the session to work on government accountability and reform. It included House members and Senate members. And so these are some of the various bills. And as I said, they've already received favorable treatment in Representative Pawlowski's committee. But for one reason or another, we're not processed by Representative Kahn's committee. I think in a couple cases they were.
And we'll get Representative Kahn an opportunity to comment about that aspect of it. Issue like
and I should point out, I think in almost every case, yep, I see them all here, we have the original authors here, Representative Loeffler, Representative Hortman, and Representative Scalzi with laryngitis, so you'll have to be kind to her if she has to get up to testify. Section 1 is the original Solberg Bill, 3587, and he can probably explain that better than anyone. Section 2 has to do with the Subcommittee on Government Accountability. It requires the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy to establish such a subcommittee, and that was originally Representative Loeffler's House File 3891. Section 3 of the Delete Everything Amendment pertains to local impact notes. Under current law, the Commissioner of Finance has to coordinate the development of a local impact note for proposed legislation, and right now, only a very few people in the legislature can request such impact notes. This just expands the list so that more committee chairs can request such notes. That was Representative Scalzi's House File 3135. Section 4 has to do with the budget format. It's just a technical cross-reference, essentially, from Representative Loeffler's House File 3891. Section 5 of the Delete Everything Amendment is originally Representative Hortman's House File 3113, which requires that performance data presented as part of the budget proposal provide information so that the legislature can determine the extent to which the agency resources are being used to achieve certain goals. In other words, the idea is to say, hey, if there's a budget proposal, how is this tied to some state goal? It basically asks for that information so that we, as we're looking at the budget numbers, can tie it to some sort of goal. Section 6 is also from Representative Loeffler, same House File 3891. It has to do with performance measures for change items. So change items in the budget to the extent possible, and we realize that it may not always be possible, but to the extent possible, show how proposed budget changes are tied to either Minnesota milestones or some other statewide goals. Section 7 of the DE amendment is from Representative Solberg's House File 3737, has to do with the cash flow forecast, and I'm sure he can explain that better than anyone here. Likewise, Section 8 has to do with Representative Solberg's original House File 3737, the deficiency requests, the timing and substance of those, and he can explain that. Section 9 pertains to the duties and rights of executive employees and comes originally from Representative Lawler's House File 3933, and it basically says that during work hours, executive branch employees are expected to be nonpartisan resources as to objective information, not as to any behind-the-scenes strategy or who said what in what meeting, but in terms of objective information, particularly budget information, it says that they are a resource to everyone and they should essentially not be muzzled as to objective information, particularly budget information. And on a related note, Section 10, also from that same House File 3933 of Representative Loeffler, it basically amends the whistleblower law to forbid employment discrimination against employees who do what we just talked about, that is, in good faith, share objective information, for example, budget information. Section 11 of the Delete Everything Amendment is from Representative Loeffler's House File 3891, has to do with the Sestwith Centennial Commission requiring it to solicit certain input and suggestions from various stakeholders. And finally, Section 12, the Delete Everything Amendment, has to do with a working group requirement. That's again from Representative Loeffler's House File 3891. It requires the Commissioner of Finance to convene a working group to assist in the preparation of recommendations for Minnesota Milestones Report that is required under the bill. Again, members, I'm introducing the amendment, but this is the work product of several legislators, and those legislators are here to answer more specific questions. I'm sure Representative Solberg can speak to the provisions that are his original provisions.
Okay, and as I mentioned, we'll be treating it as an author's amendment, so any discussion, and then we'll ask the author to explain those sections that were referenced that you would be particularly interested in, but all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion carried.
Chair,
Solberg, if you want to cut then the areas that he alluded to that you had a direct interest in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon did a wonderful job of explaining the entire bill, but let me just talk a little bit about the budget development. It allows the legislative commission or some other committee to have a little bit more say in development of a budget, to have a little bit more information. And working with the fiscal staff and within the Department of Finance as well, we've come up with this language to be able to, I think all of us on both sides of the political aisle are sometimes frustrated by the amount of information we receive and when we receive it. And so this would strengthen the ability of the legislature or committee to be able to look more into some of the base budgets, and that's what the goal of that one is. There's a couple of things on the cash flow accounts, Section 7 and Section 8. It's the timing of the cash flow accounts. We have established a cash flow account, but we really don't sometimes know what it means or how much we really need to have in there. And that's a forecast then of the cash flow account, and it helps us to understand when the state money goes out and when it comes in and how much is in our bank account at particular times. About 10 years ago, there was a small study done, and we kind of determined that the cash flow needs of the state at the time were about $280 million. So I don't know if the 350 is the right number or some other number. This would help us to determine what is the correct number for the cash flow account. And then the deficiency request is just strictly asking them for to get it in a timely fashion. Mr. Chairman, we have been working with the Department of Finance to make sure that they're comfortable with all these particular provisions, particularly the ones that I've been dealing with. Mr. Mark just talked with the Department of Finance about 1 minute ago, and they would like to have one additional little amendment, if we may, on line 4.2. Have you adopted the amendment already?
We adopted the amendment.
Okay.
Yes.
Then I would amend another amendment, if I can do an oral one, 4.2, change the 3 weeks to 30 days.
Okay. And that was the request Department of Finance.
That was a request to the Department
on the amendment. Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've explained to delete all amendment. I know there's another amendment.
Okay, any discussion on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, and I know maybe Representative Solberg, I'm getting off on a tangent, but I think you're trying to, you know, get an honest accountability here in the budget. And, you know, one of the things that's frustrated me over the years is relying on fiscal notes that I've seen. You know, I've seen $5 million fiscal notes go to zero when the administration wants them, and $0 fiscal notes go to $5 million when they don't. So, you know, is there a way we can do something in here to have some type of independent legislative budget office or the subcommittee on government accountability or somebody that can give us an unbiased fiscal note and how it's going to affect an agency? Or what the actual cost is going to be, because you've been around here longer than I, and you and Representative Carlson know that what I'm saying is true. I mean, fiscal notes can be manipulated, and they often are, and it depends on the bias of the agency or administration whether they want them or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I know that's a frustration for both sides of the political aisle at most times. We do have in the situation right now that fiscal notes are indeed advisory. So we can tell if we want a department to eat a particular cost. Both sides of the political aisle, I don't think, have gone down that road very often, in that we've said a fiscal note is a cost and it should be a legitimate cost. There is a process that takes place right now that the fiscal staff, when a fiscal note comes in and there's some question on the legitimacy of the fiscal note, the fiscal staff call the Department of Revenue or the person who has made the fiscal note and have had some discussions on, are you interpreting the bill correctly? An example of that just happened recently in one of the bills. In fact, as I think it was Representative Pawlowski's bill that we passed on the House floor, he received a fiscal note from the PCA of a $250,000 cost. And I know that before that there had been no fiscal note or no cost to that. The staff called the PCA and worked through it and said, are you interpreting the whole bill correctly? Are you interpreting your section of the bill correctly? And as a result of that conversation, they said, oh, we were misreading what the bill stated, and they revised their fiscal note. Revision of fiscal notes takes place all the time at a staff level to make sure that the people that are making the fiscal notes are correctly interpreting the process of the proposed bill. That doesn't mean that I don't agree with you that sometimes there's death by fiscal notes as well. But I think we have to be a little bit careful that we don't make a process so cumbersome that was proposed that when we're in the legislative session, if you have an appeal of a fiscal note and you go through a formal appeal of some kind, that it takes so long to get the appeal done that you never get to the appeal before the end of the fiscal, before the end of the legislative session. So I agree with your frustration sometime, and I think that's a bipartisan frustration, but I think the process that we have in place now seems to work. And maybe get to some additional explanation on this, the fiscal staff of Mr. Marks might want to comment, and he might not want to comment either.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, that's Pawlowski. He's trying to look a lot like me.
I just heard a voice from the left, and I thought he was doing a follow-up. I wasn't making a political statement, however.
I very seldom speak from the left, but but I would like to clarify something Representative Solberg said. The fiscal note that was on the disaster structural bill had been resolved in January,
in a meeting in the governor's office with the commissioner. That bill had been crafted through at least seven drafts so that it would have no fiscal note. An interpretation was made by someone in the department that did not understand the meeting that had occurred in the governor's office and prior meetings with members of the department. So in effect, it simply was an error in understanding the language. So it wasn't that there was a fiscal note that suddenly appeared and then magically went away. It was a misunderstanding of what had already occurred months before, a miscommunication inside the department. So I want that for clarification.
Mr. Chair, if I didn't state that correctly, that's absolutely correct. It was a miscommunication, a misunderstanding of what the language was saying.
Right.
And Mr. Marks, through reference, do you have anything to add? You pretty well covered.
Mr. Chair, I think the only thing I would add is that when people do have questions about fiscal notes they receive, we try to follow back on that, track it down, and have discussions about it. And I wouldn't say it's frequent, but fiscal notes do get changed, and sometimes there are simply legitimate disagreements on how interpretations or what's intended. Sometimes someone who's completing the fiscal note is misreading the language or has a different interpretation of the language, and in some cases it takes an amendment to the bill that clears things up. But when you get a fiscal note that you think is not proper, contact us. We will follow up on it.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Solberg, in the beginning section, subdivision 10 of this, the delete all amendment, it talks about a commission or the appropriate committee. What is your intent? Is it going to be a legislative commission made up of Senate and House members and some of the executive branch, or is it going to be the Ways and Means Committee or the Finance Committee? What's your I see different things there, and I'm not quite clear.
Mr. Chairman, the commission, I think, refers to the legislative legislative commission on fiscal policy. I think I've got it correct, which is a joint Senate-House commission that includes both majority and minority members. It also gives the flexibility for a committee to be able to get the information from the executive branch to develop the committee budget.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Representative Solberg, it says it may develop, but then when you, as it goes forward, you talk at the agencies, the Department of Finance, the Department of Administration, so forth and so on, must do this and they must do that and so forth and so on. So I take it that it's even though it's a may, it looks going to be a must.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I think you're reading it incorrectly. It gives the permission for them to do it, but if they decide to do it, then the agencies must provide the information. That's where the must is. It doesn't refer that the commission or the committees must.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Solberg, haven't we had this in the past?
Mr. Chairman, not at this particular level in the past. And I think both sides of the political aisle and the legislature have been frustrated by sometimes the lack of information that has come forward from agencies.
Okay, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Solberg. On Section 9, which is on page 413 throughout that page and the next page, I guess, that section is highly controversial. If you start on line 4.14, it says, executive branch state employees are expected during their work hours to be nonpartisan resources to all decision makers and to provide timely professional assistance to both executive and legislative decision makers and their staffs, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm having a hard time understanding why that is needed, because I think separation of powers between the branches is extremely important. And also, I don't understand how functionally it would work. Who would be the master of these employees? If I were an employee for the executive branch, it would be, I think, confusing to know who my boss was. Do I work for the executive branch, do I work for the agency, or do I have to work for whichever legislator or decision maker calls me? I'm wondering, there's all sorts of questions here. I'm wondering if there's union contract issues at hand here, and I'm wondering if that could create a conflict of interest. There's reasons why executive branch may need to have privacy on some matters, and just the language, executive branch and state employees, I don't know if that means all employees. I just think that this is a very controversial part of the bill, and I'm wondering, I don't know, maybe this is a question for our research staff, but I'm trying to understand, or have our House analysts or any of our staff had problems getting information from the executive branch? Is that what this is all about? And if that's so, could you give very specific examples of what that might be?
Mr. Chair, this comes from somebody else's section of the bill, and maybe I can have some help in this.
Representative Simon,
well.
Representative Simon? Or are you going to be first?
I was going to, thank you, Mr. Chair, I was going to hand it off to Representative Loeffler, if you'll allow that,
that'll
Mr. Chair.
Because it was originally her house. Representative Loeffler, on a couple of occasions, I had laryngitis when I was still actively teaching, and my students were very kind and gentle and didn't engage me unnecessarily when I had to whisper, but do the best you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, you're doing quite fine.
And members, I am, this actually wasn't very controversial when it went to Government Operations Committee.
Oh, you're not the one with laryngitis.
I'm not the one.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
It was Representative Kelsey that has laryngitis.
Yeah,
you couldn't
no,
be talking about
everything
healthy.
I wasn't quite sure if you were saying you did or not.
No, I misunderstood. I thought it was you that had it, but go ahead. We can hear you just fine.
Certainly. Well, this actually, I mean, I believe that state employees are all of our employees. They are the people that we hire to administer and implement state law. And while they are part of the executive branch, because the executive branch is responsible for implementation of our directives and our programs, this is to just clarify that when a legislative staff person or a legislator has a question and wants basic information about our services, our budget, our finances, that they are a resource to us, not just to the executive committee office. And I think there's some confusion about that now. It clearly says that you know, there's a work that's around their workload, there's a consult with managers, if it's an issue, it's not to interfere with it. But I've heard from legislative staff who said just even basic questions about caseload, number of people served, and trying to develop a legislative proposal for us, it'll take, you know, a week or two to get answers because they have to go up through this chain of command because they're just not sure what they can or can't tell us. I had a legislative staff or a administrative staff person say, you know, I think it was, I had a constituent who was basically told me, they told me in orientation I'm not supposed to talk to legislators about my job. And I don't, I mean, he doesn't have to talk to me about his job, but if I call up and I just want to know how many people are served by her program, that seems to me like a pretty basic question. And I see it working just as our non-citizen health research works right now. I don't think they have any question of who they work for. And I think when I was in the minority and now in the majority, I think I've gotten equal professional resources and information to help me do my job in terms of helping serve the state of Minnesota. And that's the intention of this year.
Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, if I misspoke in my introduction, to make sure that the record is straight, the Department of Finance does not support this particular section. Representative Pepin is correct on that. By Ms. Book.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler and Solberg. I think it's my understanding that the contract negotiator for Doer was very much against this portion of the bill as well. But I think this is very problematic because for the reasons I stated before, but I'm wondering if it would work the same way then for all, if you would be open to perhaps a friendly amendment that would make it reciprocal so that the agency too would have the same access to legislative staff.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, I think it's a different. You'll note that on line 4.17, it's in understanding the current service and finance system and the potential impact of changes in these systems. This is when you're asking about the programs that we've given them the authority to implement and direct. And that information resides in those people who we've entrusted program management responsibilities and implementation responsibilities to. And since we're asked to routinely make decisions about, you know, what our service system should be, they're the people who have that information. I think that's very different than the type of information our legislative staff have.
Well, thank you. I won't, I guess I'll leave it until the floor, but I think this is very problematic, and I remember when this came before us, I think it was in state government, I did ask the fiscal staff person there if she had had any problems at any time getting any information she needed from the executive branch, and she basically said no. And I hadn't heard from any of our fiscal analysts or anybody at that level that they'd had problems doing this. I would think that, I know that whenever I've had questions, I haven't had a problem. My concern is just putting this in statute. I think you really could put an employee in a bind, because the legislation would require all executive branch employees, and that could be at the lowest level. And I would just think that that could cause all sorts of potential legal issues and whatnot. And boy, if I were working as an executive in any of the state departments, I would be very worried about this. Worried that if a legislative staff person called or a legislator called, that I, you know, I wouldn't know how to prioritize between that call and my normal day-to-day job. I think that I've never had a problem. I think they do it because they, to help out, and they know that they need to do that. But putting it in state statute, I think, puts this into a whole new level, and I'm very much opposed to this. And Representative Solberg, I would hope you would consider taking this out or revamping this before we vote on this on the floor.
Mr. Chair, let me just relate something that I thought was kind of telling, and maybe it's a management style or a culture. But I'm going to go back to what was, I thought, was extremely disturbing on the mesothelioma situation. And the first hearing that Representative Park and Representative Rukavina held on that particular issue, when the commissioner did not release the information on the mesothelioma for several reasons. And it's one of the, I think, the most telling emails that was obtained by, I guess, the press, was an email from an employee within the department that said that, well, what if we don't get the $100,000 or whatever they were requesting from the federal government? And I think if I paraphrase what the email said, was if the press finds out about this, it'll be very difficult to explain. And you know how, and I think they used the word sensitive, and you know how sensitive it is to ask for a state appropriation. Somebody down in the lower level knew about this as well and was really afraid to come before anybody and say, we got a problem. And the health care issue is the magnitude of the mesothelioma on their range. And I think, you know, if there would have been a legislator that would have said, can an employee down below the commissioners or somebody else tell me if there's a problem? They would have probably said, we can't answer that. Now, maybe that's, again, not a problem, but more of a culture that has existed. But I think that particular email disturbed me more than anything else. If we have created a culture in state government that we're afraid to ask for money to implement public health. And I don't know if this solves the problem or not, but then I think it's an attempt of the frustration that exists within sometimes state government. And I don't blame this administration. I've worked under all kinds of administrations, and that's been kind of a thing that happens. It's my information, and if you don't ask the right questions, you don't get the right, what's the information you're looking for. It may answer your question, but it may not be what you're looking for because you didn't answer it in the correct fashion. So I understand it's controversial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg. Do you believe that if this legislation had been in place, the outcome would have been any different than it was with the situation that you spoke of with the Department of Health? How would this have changed it in any way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't know if it would have or not, but I said this, if you, I think what I said, is that this is a result of some of that frustration, and it's an attempt to be able to do some of those things. And I think that there's also another provision in here in the, to protect employees a little bit stronger in the whistleblowing section. I think that's in section, as I understand it, section 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg. That's the section, I think they're trying to kill a mosquito with a sledgehammer, if that's their goal.
I'm sorry.
I think you're trying to kill a mosquito with a sledgehammer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, coming from northern Minnesota, if I can kill a mosquito, that's always good.
I think that may be a more statewide comment than you realize. But Pepin, were you done?
Thank you, Representative Solberg. Something you said, Representative Solberg, about Section 10, I'm assuming you're talking about Section F, and you said something about a whistleblower suit, and was it Representative Trumper? Could you explain that a little bit more? You said something about whistleblower.
Well, my understanding is that that helps protect an employee in a whistleblower type of thing if they do provide information. That's my understanding of it.
Thank you.
I don't know where Chumper came in.
I think she just
used the wrong name.
Used the wrong name.
Okay.
That was just an error. Representative Clark?
My question was about Section 9 as well, and I think I just wanted to clarify one thing. And I've been lost to do it, but it might respond to some of the points that Representative Pepin was making. One of the things that has been very frustrating as a chair is to try to get good information sometimes from staff who are from an agency to tell us what they really think would be necessary. For example, the appropriation that's needed for, say, housing is one of the areas that I cover. Just to try to get that information, sometimes very difficult. I think what this clarifies, if I understand the way this is written in Section B, Section 9B, the person who is advocating for the position of the executive branch, they have to have that, if I understand this right, Representative Lawson, is she still there? They have to have that... that responsibility or that requirement be listed in their job description, and so that's the accountability factor that I think is there. Is that right? They're going to know ahead of time, and we're going to know that the legislators will know that particular employee has as part of their job description to advocate the executive branch's policy and political goals. And so it won't be a surprise. It'll be a way of having accountability. Is that what the intent is there?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, this is not to in any way try and stop the executive from doing what they need to do with people that they've chosen and that they, in confidence, are putting together strategies and policies and advocating for them. So we would expect their commissioner and their assistant commissioners, their appointed people, to actually play an advocacy role. There's other people in the department, legislative liaisons, who play that role as well. And it's just to make clear that is their job to really be the advocates for the executive's authority and to not take that away. That's also addressed in the line 4.21 and 4.22 that it says it does not authorize or require disclosure of data that's not public data. We, under Chapter 13, we have protections in Chapter 13 where the governor's preliminary budget decisions, policy, trial balloons, et cetera, are currently protected in our law. And this is to say that still is protected and exclusive to the executive branch. It's just saying for people who are just your, basic classified good civil servant who's spent 15 years working at a program, that they can provide basic information to us that we can use in our decision making.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I do think that protection is clarified, and thank you for going over that.
Mr. Chair, I think there is another amendment that's been offered, I believe, also.
I have a... question of Representative Loeffler. It's not a current situation. In fact, it's some years ago, but we had great difficulty getting information from one of the higher education systems. When you're saying state employees here, are you covering the higher education systems as well?
Mr.
In your interpretation of the language?
Mr. Chairman, I would actually defer that to legal counsel. I think the university, for example, has a unique status. I'm not sure the normal interpretation of this. And Mark Shepard is coming up.
Actually, it wasn't the university that was the problem, and they do have constitutional autonomy. They're kind of the opposite. You ask them a question, and I think they're supposed to bury you with information. Okay. Through the years, we would ask for things to be consolidated a bit. So you weren't getting volumes, but that may just be the way University of Minnesota professors and administrators sometimes are. But in answer to the question.
I'm Mr. Chair, members, Mark Shepard from House Research. This is codified in Chapter 43A, and under that chapter, MNSCU employees generally are considered to be state employees. University of Minnesota employees are not.
Okay, thank you. We've got several on the list, so we'll keep adding Representative Leader, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the bill, there's a lot of reference to Minnesota milestones, and I understand the concept and all that, but is that defined in statute because there's a lot of reference to it?
Representative
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe it is, and I think there's references. I know this is kind of in several different places in this amendment, so I'm just kind of quick scattering. I know that there's a provision. It's in 16A, 10, subdivision 1C, so it is defined in statute. It's a system, a program that was established under the Carlson administration and has been used off and on as a way to kind of measure our progress. It addresses sort of broad, long-range goals, such as Minnesotans will live in safe communities, and you have a variety of measures of correctional crime statistics. Those are, that's the kind of example of what the Minnesota milestones are.
Representative Leader, does that answer? Representative Follett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also to Representative Solberg and to Representative Pepin's comments. Not to backtrack too much, but you know, there's lots of specific examples. As a finance chair of early childhood, we have had enormous problems with the Department of Human Services and with the Department of Education trying to coordinate on early childhood programs. One specific example, if you want one, they're probably listening or maybe they're in the room, is the allowance program that was allocated last year. We couldn't get information about how the money was being spent. We couldn't get information how the program was being designed. We got thrown from department to department back and forth between the two. That's why there was a proposal for a Department of Early Childhood, because we have a lot of trouble dealing with the departments. We did have a legislator this year that was told by one of the department employees, and I did bump it up to an assistant commissioner, that they thought they would be fired if they shared certain information with that legislator. Actually, they did share the information and then thought they might be fired for doing that. That kind of stuff shouldn't go on. When I was here, I was elected in 96 and came in 97. Public employees served the public. And that's what they were here for. If we requested things from them, they weren't taking political positions and positions of covering whatever the issues were there that they were uncomfortable sharing. So I think at least for what we're dealing with in our area, we see a lot of this. And I'm happy to meet with those people. Hopefully they'll want to after this. But I think we do need this. It's really been a frustration, and it's not changing. If anything, you know what? It's getting a lot worse.
Yeah.
So, I just want to speak in support of it.
Mr. Chair, members, actually on the second portion on page 5, that paragraph, mm-hmm. underlined paragraph, I don't have any problem with that at all. In fact, the other day I tried to intervene for a National Guard employee, and shortly after I did, the sergeant came up behind her and said, "You could get in a lot of trouble for talking to that legislator." about an insignificant thing in a countless number of times in my past working as a 22 years as a state employee. Employees were threatened when we opened our mouths to answer legislators, and so I like that idea. The only concern that I would have is that if you make a request to a state agency, if you're going to let all employees flap their jaws at the same time as the boss you want the information from, and unguarded information come up, the employee sometimes can get kind of frustrated because, or the supervisor, because you've asked them for the information, and then information starts streaming in from all over everybody's opinion. And if the employer can't say, hey, hold off a minute, don't you be sending 40 different messages to the legislator who's requesting the information, that should be some concern. I don't know if your bill, you know, reflects that concern or not, but I do like the ability for the employees to say whatever they want to the legislator, get it off their chest, and you know, work through a problem.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to that, this does not stop and does not prohibit current practices in several departments that I know of that require employees, when a legislator or a legislative staff person has made an inquiry, for them to just write up an email saying so-and-so asked about this and this is the information I shared, to just make sure that it's accurate, is what they're told, is that they want to make sure that the information we get is complete and that employee understood it. And I don't think this would prohibit that kind of reporting. But it does mean that we should get timely responses, and that kind of review shouldn't take, you know, excessive amounts of time.
Okay. we have an amendment that President Kahn wanted to offer, yes. So I think this would be the time to offer it.
This is the A1 amendment, and I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, President Kahn moves the amendment.
This amendment was actually part of the state government finance bill that we passed last year, and it was very modified from its original form. I don't remember what the impetus for finally taking it out. I don't remember if it was Senate objections or governor's objections, but anyway, I thought it's worthwhile to present it again. This is the concept of a continuing resolution to continue appropriations, to give a little bit more time for budget negotiation before the end of the session. And the last time that we came close to a government, the last time that we had a government shutdown, in fact, it was interesting because there are about five or six states where the legislature did not manage to do an appropriation an appropriation bill, and there was only one shutdown, and that was in Minnesota. This is, we don't have exact figures on this, but this is an enormous cost. I originally wrote the bill to continue indefinitely, and with input from other people, it's just extended it for 1 month. There's just an enormous effort of uncounted expenses, besides the expenses that we could count, of the special master and the time to go to court and so forth to do that. There's an enormous amount of emotional expense that state employees go through. As they've got the employees themselves, besides the people who are dependent on those, who are dependent on those appropriations. As we're approaching the government shutdown, you know, work kind of stops in a lot of places as people try and reconfigure things like vacations that they may have planned for over a year that they now suddenly need to reconfigure to take in that time. This is just us? Yeah, well, I don't have that much sympathy. We're pretty stressed out too, but we, you know, we kind of apply for this job to be stressed out. But this just gives another month of negotiation. I don't think that we get to any kind of unreasonable delay. I think everyone wants it. Just continues the base level. Items which were not part of the base do not continue. And I think everyone, both sides, usually want some changes in the budget. And I think that this is just a reasonable way. We hope that this will not happen again. It didn't happen last time. This is just a reasonable way to make passing a deadline. It doesn't really remove the deadline, but it makes going past the deadline less hurtful to the people of the state. So I move the amendment.
Representative Solberg.
This guy gets okay at the same.
With that ringing endorsement, Mr. Chairman,
I think Representative Solberg and I may be on somewhat the same page. Representative Kahn, any questions or comments on her amendment? Okay, Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, it looks like there could be a little bit of a financial.
No.
Well, just the implications of it, not necessarily just in the wording, but the implications of the verbiage there that later on there could be some. So I'm just concerned about it from that standpoint.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I only see it as cost saving. And it isn't continual. It's only most of the other places, like the state of Wisconsin, which did avoid a government shutdown, and I think last year went for some considerable time without an appropriation bill, has had this for some time. And as I said, it was very 4 years ago. Whenever we did have the government shutdown, it was just, you know, Minnesota stood out as the only state that was in this quandary. And the state, since then, I think the state of New Jersey actually did have a government shutdown at some point, and it literally cost them millions. I mean, their government shutdown, I think the serious thing that happened when the government shutdown occurred, and it was, I don't remember what the circumstances, I don't remember if they have exactly the same deadline as we do for fiscal one, was that the government runs the casinos, and the fact that the casinos in Atlantic City had to actually shut down literally cost millions to the state.
No, be careful, Mr. Chair. This may be a vehicle now for the casino.
I don't think so. So,
Representative Solberg, when I counted the way I did, I'd like to think this through because it gives the upper hand, at least for 31 days, to whoever the administration might be at a given point in time. And depending on the administration's motivations, I just would like to think that through. But if you're comfortable with putting it on and we have further discussions to be so that we would understand what the impact might be. It's a pretty rare event, as you pointed out, Representative.
And, Mr. Chairman, I will point out that we did think it through last year, at least to the end when it was removed. But we did think it through because it was in the state government finance bill that the House passed.
The other thing, Representative Solberg, one might argue that this amendment would have the bill now go through Ways and Means if it's adopted. That's your interpretation.
Mr. Chair, I do not have a fiscal implication on it. It as Representative Kahn states, it has the potential to save money. I think that's a legitimate argument, and I could change my argument either way on that particular one, I guess, on one hand and on the other hand, but I'm comfortable with it going through Ways and Means as well.
I got feedback on that question from somebody who worked closely with both.
Sure. So. It does have some potential. I think Representative Kahn is correct in that there was, you either delay it, that government action of this, and allow more time for negotiations. So you may delay some of the expenditures that took place in May of 2 years ago for a month. But it may also have things in that respect as well. So, Mr. Chair, I would change my motion if this is adopted by the Ways and Means. I need some advice from the chief fiscal staff, and
well,
he's closer to you than he is to me right now.
He's giving me some advice that's a little different than what your answer is.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Mark, if you don't mind getting them to the middle of it.
Mr. Chair, it's not exactly an appropriation of a given amount of money, but the potential is here for 30 days worth of appropriations under this particular section, the line one, or page one, line 11, appropriates money, or potentially appropriates money if the situation occurs.
So, the distinguished chair of the...
Well, Mr. Chair, it appears that with that kind of advice, whenever we appropriate money, the Ways and Means should see it.
So the... if the amendment goes on, we'll address that question if the amendment goes on, and I suspect it may. Representative Lanchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, I'm just trying to understand. So in a deficit situation, where would the revenue come from if this amendment was added? And how do you continue appropriations when you haven't passed a revenue source?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this continues it only for 1 month. So I think we're not, all tax bills, all tax legislation continues. That doesn't stop at the time of, that doesn't stop. So the state's revenue picture pretty much remains the same.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Well, Representative Kahn, that's true when we're not in a deficit, because if the income tax doesn't stop and sales tax doesn't stop, but when the receipts are declining and we're going in the hole, the next month we'd just be further in the hole. So I'm trying to understand, in a deficit cycle, everything's kind of pumping along here, how do you appropriate for another 30 days when you're already going in the other direction without a revenue source?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we require our budget to be in balance for a biennium, and it's really hard to understand how things could be so bad that the biennial, we'd be in the tank for the biennium in 1 month.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, Representative Kahn, you and I were both here in the $4.5 billion deficit when the tobacco was blown through and the inflation wasn't counted and all the reserves were completely gone and we were still declining. So it's happened, and I'm just trying to figure out, in a significant deficit cycle, which I hope we're not heading to, but we could be, how would this play out? And that's what I don't understand.
Mr. Chairman, and one of the things is we would hope that we would finish everything before the legislative deadline. I mean, we do have, there is an incentive to do this. All this does is give a little more time in case we haven't finished at that time.
Thank you.
And I was in contact with lots of state agencies at that time, and there were very many unseen costs to that government shutdown. Besides the costs that we did see, the actual setting up of the special master and the amount of time that people spent testifying before the special master and so forth. I do have, this is a question of negotiation policy about whether deadlines, coming up against an absolute deadline, is very important for negotiation policy. I actually have a very large analysis on this, which deals with male and female modes of negotiation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm getting more information than what I need to know.
If I go into great detail, I may lose every male vote on the committee. So I prefer to just kind of say it's a good idea without going into detail about the biological constraints on negotiation, going from lions and lionesses and so forth. So
I think, Representative Kahn, what some of us are trying to say is that at least two of us, and I think maybe even a third one that deals with appropriations, chimed in, we want to make sure that there are no unforeseen pitfalls with this kind of an amendment and what that might mean if we were in a difficult situation or with a given administration and or some of the issues I think that Representative Lanchesky was pointing out is So at least when I say for now, I meant I want to
sure.
be sure I know what the ups and downs of something like this would be as it goes forward. And I would hope that you'd be open to those kinds of discussions as the maker of the amendment.
We've got one other person wanting
to comment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I can just point out that the language gives a lot of flexibility as to what the amount appropriated is, and it be made on a proration of the annual amount or other reasonable basis. So I imagine, for example, if we're looking at a decline in projections, that proration of the reasonable basis could include the anticipation of even less revenue coming in. So,
but Mr. Chair, that does bring up another situation that we need to visit with, and that is if we almost have been for at least 1 month a open and standing appropriation, that we have a maximum on it, but the legislature appropriates the dollar amount and we allow the we don't appropriate less than the dollar amount. So I think we need to at least have some discussion. But as I stated earlier on, if we want to have this go forward, that's fine, and we'll have some additional discussions on that. Okay.
Tax committee need to see it.
No.
I'm just sitting here puzzling on that. That's the, you know, the revenue implications.
That's why I'm asking the question.
They're hanging out there. I'm gonna.
Well,
Madam Chairman, this has no tax implications at all. I really don't see that at all.
I think some of us are interpreting this quite a bit differently your interpretation, Representative Kahn. That's why we're having some dilemmas here as to what the impact of this truly is.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, unless I'm misunderstanding it, I mean, it appears to me it would have to be seen by taxes. Well, the tax committee, you know, folks forget this. What the tax committee sees, and you can read it in the rule, is revenues up or down, tax increases raised or lowered, or anything that impacts revenue policy. So it doesn't have to be connected to a tax outright. And it's hard for me to see how this wouldn't affect that area, but I'm trying to quietly listen and not, you know, be the bad guy here, but I'm having a hard time understanding this.
We're all trying to be kind. And
I know. I really see this. Mr. Chairman.
Even though we have reservations.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, let me point out that this went through the tax committee last year. It was part of the bill. Not one question was raised about this item in the tax committee last year. One of the things is that you have to learn is you do, you know, the bill that it was in actually had a 4.5-page veto message. I think it was a state record, maybe even a national record on veto messages. But the you know, this is not a new concept. It occurs in many states, including our neighboring state, and it's been, you know, it kept Wisconsin last year from having to shut down government, and whatever their time was, they came very close. I think to shutting it down.
Representative Earhart, I passed over you and I didn't mean to do that. Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, I think that you create another cliff here and that this is not very flexible. I mean, you're just saying, well, we'll go another 30 days and see if we can fall off another cliff. And secondly, you kind of put us legislators in the position of being second-class citizens again by saying, well, what do I care about you and I and Representative Garrows here? I mean, I planned my last pregnancy to end and then we went on into July. And I mean, how is that fair to us?
Representative Kahn.
Well, I should touch that one at the end of the poll.
Mr. Chairman, one says one hopes this is only, you know, it's not clearly not a last resort because we're only doing it for a month. It clearly just gives a little bit more time to come. And there was at least one of these years, I don't remember, where we came to it pretty quickly, like within a week or something like that. And so I think, you know, I think we didn't have to come to, you know, we don't actually start shutting down until that first month is over. We don't, well, all right, yes, from the time the legislature is out, we do go some distance. I don't remember, in the Ventura administration, maybe you remember, Representative Silver, didn't we come very close to it, but didn't do it, and it took the Pawlenty discussion to... to come down and do it?
I don't recall exactly. It was, I think, in the second term of the Ventura administration. It was, we went past the deadline.
But we came to an agreement pretty quickly.
Well, we came to an agreement, I think, on June 30th or something like
that.
Yes. So. Let's see what the outcome of the amendment is, and then we can decide whether it goes from here to Ways and Means or from here to taxes. Any further discussion on the con amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion defeated. Representative Solberg renews his motion then that House File 3587 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion on the motion?
Well, does it need to go to Ways and Means though if that amendment's not on there?
Are we clear for the General Register?
Yes.
Oh, okay, to the General Register. Okay. I'll restate that then as amended and placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for a very beneficial hearing. I appreciate that.
We're going to go, Representative Johnson has one. Hopefully these will go fairly quickly, at least I'm told that they will. Representative Johnson. The chair moves that the Energy Policy and Finance Division report for House File 2959, the first engrossment, be adopted. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The chair moves that Senate File 2866, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Johnson, you have an amendment that you would like added?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I've got a couple of them here. Are they both yours?
That's correct. The first one's the A1 amendment, and that substitutes the House language for the Senate language.
Okay, and so the Chair moves the amendment. And this is just a procedural one to substitute the language so you can present the bill, as I assume.
Correct.
Major differences between the House and Senate in the amendment?
No major differences. It's
okay.
Better.
We're in the process of having it passed out, so it is now out. Okay. Yeah, it's in your packet. The original bill is in your packet, and we're just substituting the Senate language. Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Now you have the A2 amendment. This is also puts it in the form you would like.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Chair moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Johnson, then on the bill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, members, what H
What this particular bill does is it funds a project that will produce a comprehensive statewide inventory and mapping of existing broadband service and capability. So as we move forward with our broadband goals and task force, we had a hearing on the House floor this past week about broadband task force. This will be information that will be very useful for the task force and for community as we look forward to further the goal of broadband availability and service throughout the state of Minnesota.
Any questions or discussion on the bill? Seeing none, then the chair renews motion that Senate file 2866, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Johnson, you have now House File 2351. And that was in division as well, so the chair moves the Energy Policy and Finance Division report on the House File 2351, the first engrossment. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. We have amendments on this one, too. Okay, the chair moves that House File 2351, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Now, again, Representative Johnson, you have
the
one amendment.
Mm-hmm. One amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and that deals with the appropriation. So the chair moves the H-2351A3 amendment. Just a brief comment about what it is.
What it does, Mr. Chair, is changes the funding source from TAP to TAM, the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund.
Okay. Any discussion?
Sure.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, what's the cost on this study?
The study is $85,000, Representative Westrum,
and
one-time appropriation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, this comes out of the access charge. That what's this fund pay for usually?
The fund is used for, thank you, Mr. Chair, to make Minnesota's telecommunications system fully accessible to communications-impaired persons. That's what the fund is used for. After the expenditure, Representative Westrum, there will be approximately $1.5 million fund in balance.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I guess maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what the study is doing, because I think it's probably a valuable study. I'm just questioning whether we should divert from this fund versus finding another source. This fund has generally been fairly specific for access issues for persons with disabilities, and could you just share a little bit more about what the study is going to do and why you think it's consistent with this fund?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, over the past year, the Telecommunications Committee has met with interested stakeholders and folks to look at the issue of statewide video franchising. Currently, cable TV franchising is done at the municipal level. There's been initiatives throughout the country and through various states to look at what the impact moving to a statewide franchising would be. Different folks on different sides of that issue raised a variety of points, and there was a lot of disagreement on what the impact would be on local franchises and franchise fees and PEG issues and institutional networks and build-out requirements and the like. And given the fact that there was so much lack of clarity on what the actual impact would be of statewide franchising, the notion of having a study to get some basic information so we can make some well-informed policy decisions is what the origin of this bill is.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I guess that's the concern. do you not have any concern about taking money out of this fund that that we pay on our bills? Everyone pays on their phone bills for access for persons with disabilities, and we're now just finding it as a fund that's got a surplus, because I think the other thing members should know is Representative Johnson, you can confirm this, but I believe this tax, per the direction of PUC, goes up and down as that fund has balances or surpluses. And so to just go to this fund because there's $1.5 million surplus is the issue. I don't dispute the study or the idea of let's look at it. I have the concern of the precedents we set with just going to this fund and taking it for what I would say might be not relevant to what its purpose is.
Mr. Chair, just for members' knowledge, I guess that what TAM is, it's funded by a surcharge on all access lines, wired and wireless. I think it's currently at 5 cents per line per month. And I think this is an important project that needs to be done, needs to be completed. And given the fact that there will be sufficient money in the TAM fund after this $85,000 is spent, I think it's good public policy and good use of good use of money.
And by the way, for members' information, this appropriation, and I think this language as well, is in 1812.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
That's the budget balance bill. In case
Mr. Chair, I didn't support that bill either. So.
No, your questions are appropriate. I just, for information to members, wanted them to know that that's the second location of the issue. Okay, any further questions or comments on the amendment?
Not on the amendment, on the bill.
Oh, okay. All those in favor, then, of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Steffen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, I know this is just a study, but to me it looks like it's a move towards statewide cable franchising, which I wouldn't support because it would take the control away from local governments and it would take the private sector out of it. I'm wondering, first of all, if this is moving in the Senate, where it's at, and then second of all, if you can tell me a little bit about who the proponents and opponents are. I would think that the local governments would be opposed to this. I don't know if they've spoken up or not, and obviously I would think the cable industry would not like this. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about where this is coming from, where the push is for this, and then where it's at in the Senate as well.
There's a couple of different perspectives, I suppose, you could take. So, one, given the monopoly situation of cable companies currently have over much of the major metropolitan area, I think that there's an interest in providing some competition in the cable TV work so that we can get some prices lower for consumers. So that's definitely a push. Competition probably being the big driver.
Mr. Solberg, Representative Johnson, do you think by having the government regulate this would provide more competition? Is that what your thought is?
Well, currently the municipalities are the franchising agent. What this would do if it passed, go through, it'd be a long process. It has to go through persons like you. You'd have to weigh in on it. The state would be the franchising agent, and therefore if an applicant came looking for a cable franchising, they wouldn't have to apply to every municipality and city throughout the state. They'd go to one place to get their franchise and then go from there.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. I was just wondering if you could follow through with the other parts of my question, who the supporters of this, the opponents, and then where this is at in the Senate.
It's had some discussion in the Senate, and it has had, I believe, a hearing on that side. Whether it's going to move to the point of passing or whether, I can't say. Some of the opponents and proponents of the telephone company lineup on the side of seeing statewide franchising, the cable
cable companies are certainly more interested in the current status.
How about local
governments? Local governments are interested in seeing how the whole thing plays out. They'd have to speak for themselves. But they would certainly have concerns, I think, probably over the major issues, and this is why the study is important, over the institutional networks, the PEG issues, and then the franchise fees. I think if those matters could be resolved in a way that's satisfactory, they might be open to it, but they'd have to speak for themselves.
You, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, what happens to, there are a lot of benefits to the cities and local units of government when they negotiate these contracts, not only to monetary, but also right-of-ways for their towers and all that stuff. What happens to that? Is that's taking something away that the local units of government are using for budget, I would think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good question. And those are some of the issues I think the study's going to have to delve into and get some answers to. Certainly we've got to make sure that our cities are taken care of and they're not reduced in funding any more than they currently have been. So you raise good issues.
Representative Earhart,
that's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Just on that issue, and this bill really doesn't have anything to do with it, but there's nothing in any discussions. The cities like to raise that issue, and so I'm sorry, it's a little pet peeve of mine. Nothing that we're going to do with video franchise is going to take away any right-of-way authority of any city, and so I wish people would just stop talking about it, because it's just not true.
Okay, any further discussion on the bill?
Wait a minute here, Mr. Chairman. I've got something to say about that one. Who's to say what the hell we're going to do? I mean, that's the slightest statement if I ever heard of. And I'm going to think you're right, old city. You're moving toward it right now. I mean, you're saying we're going to preempt to the negotiations between the cities and other local units of government, putting the state agency. I don't see how you could think we're not going to take the rights away.
Mr. Chair, no bill that has ever been on this issue and it's been talked about for many years has ever gone down this path, and so that's just not the case.
Well, Mr. Chair, that may not be the case, but that's the way you're headed.
Any further discussion? Okay, the Chair moves then that House File 23, or renews his motion that House File 2351, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr.
Johnson,
Chair.
Johnson, you were going to say?
Thank you.
Oh, we haven't voted yet. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Johnson?
Thank you. I have nothing else to add.
Oh, you looked like you were going to say.
Nope.
Okay, you're very welcome. Have a good day. Let's see, we are now on Senate File 3158. That's the one that Representative Saylor, co-author on the bill, will be presenting, even though the agenda says Mo. It'll be Representative Saylor. And Representative Saylor, care to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I would like to move Senate File 3158, first engrossment, recommend to pass, and move to the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Could you explain the bill?
This bill is for a study to address a situation that has been kind of building with regard to the tourism industry in particular, but there has been noted over the past several years more and more of an increase of people with private homes renting these homes out to people, particularly those that advertise, for instance, on the web or through some sort of internet base, to be renting out their private home. This is not talking about, individuals, families, Aunt Betsy or whoever renting to someone else, but the fact that this we need to address the possible tax compliance issues when people are not, someone wants to come up to vacation in a certain area, and if they would be renting a private home rather than a resort, we would be seeing implications, negative implications for the tourism industry. And also there are some concerns about protecting consumers. Private homes are not designed to be resorts, basically. Their septic systems are not designed for that. And if there are zoning regulations in a particular area, that is not taken into effect either, or account, I should say. There are issues with rental safety, promotion of tourism, and this is a study to address these issues and any others that come up. It was brought before some of the members, anyway, that attended the tourism conference in Mankato earlier this year. And it's a significant concern to folks in tourism. So that's why Representative Moe brought this bill forward, and I'm the second author on that. So it's just for study. So, members, I ask for your approval.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Saylor, specifically, were there individuals or people that have gone to northern Minnesota or to places like this, and were there concerns that were brought back to Representative Moe or yourself that they'd had problems in doing it? I would think this would be a private matter between the person's home and the individual who wants to use it.
Representative Anderson, yes, as a matter of fact, there have been specific examples, and I think we're trying to be very clear not to get down into areas where it's, you know, somebody's private home and somebody that they know, a relative, that sort of a situation. We're not trying to get involved in that at all. This is much more to deal with the issue of people actually advertising on a website or on the internet, you know, people they don't even know going out and actually promoting, and it would be in direct contradiction, actually, in competition to the local resort. And there have been individuals, I actually have known of some of them in prior years, but didn't recognize it for what it was until, you know, this issue came up as something, you know, with a broader base. And so that's why we want to have this study to look at this issue.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sitter, was there a negative impact on this couple or this individual as far as financial, or was there some harm that was done? You know, from a, I don't know what perspective you could say, but was impact?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the potential impact, negative if you will, would be if someone would decide, I'm going to rent from this private owner rather than to, you know, contact a resort. And so it could be a negative impact and has been, I believe, to resorts and others in the tourism lodging industry, if people are going to be deciding instead to answer an internet opportunity to stay at a private home. The other thing that is raised in this, and is one of the things that we'll look at in the study, is the fact that, and you can probably imagine this sort of thing, you know, homes are not sized, their septic systems are not sized for commercial establishments, you know, to those guidelines. And if someone is renting out a home on a continual basis, and you never know. I've actually seen situations like this where somebody has, that's kind of maybe not the homeowner, has a lot of people come up, a lot of friends, a lot, you know, so-and-so's got the house, let's invite everybody we know, let's all stay there. And granted, that happens in private homes, that is their business, totally their business. But if this is happening on a continual basis, there may be problems with the septic system, there may also be problems with just safety issues in general. When people rent a cabin at a resort, or if they're at a motel, they expect to have, you know, fire safety and other consumer protections in place. In a private home, of course, that's not the case. So there are those issues that need to be addressed, and that's what the study is about.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Saylor, it's the potential that this might happen, not that there actually is a specific case and point. It's almost like the shutdown of the state of Minnesota. We know it did happen once, but Representative Kahn's amendment was to hopefully prevent that from, and when you're looking at that, not happening for the tourism industry, too.
Representative Taylor.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. Actually, I do know when certain people have rented homes rather than rent at a resort, the resort has lost the business. That is one of the things that this study will address. And so there actually have been situations that has occurred.
Representative Dunkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, there's good studies, there's bad studies, and I apologize, Representative Saylor, because Frank Moe isn't here, but I really see no... I'm really struggling with this bill. You know, this is a local zoning issue. You can rent if you want. Then it becomes non-homestead taxes if it's the majority of your income, and that's a local tax collection issue. There's not fire and safety or sewer. That's a local zoning issue. But any one of us, and Pitt, the prime example right now is the GOP convention. Mm-hmm. All kinds of homes being offered for rent. And you can do that. You can do that. You go to Italy, you travel in Europe, you can rent homes all over this world, all over this planet. And so somehow to look, and I don't know what this is even doing. I've tried, and again, it's not you. So I wish Representative Moe was here, but I just do not see $5,000 to study what? You know, we can all rent homes. It's a local issue. I mean, seriously, I feel bad for this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dunkey, with all of the resorts in that may or may not be located in your area, those of us that do represent resort areas, do understand that this is an issue. It's an issue with tax implications as well. As more and more people would look at using internet, using just getting around our Montauk resorts and getting around our motels and that sort of a thing. You know, I think that it's different when we're talking about the Republican convention. That wasn't even part of this. I don't think that was what Representative Moe had in mind at all. But, you know, that is one particular event. It certainly wasn't part of the scope or intent of this bill. At least it's my understanding it was not. But because the resort industry in the northern part of the state, and presumably other parts as well, as we're not the only ones that have resorts, it has been identified as an issue, and those of us that represent resort areas took seriously the concerns of the businesses in our area, and also the fact that it is a potential loss of revenue for the state of Minnesota, and that was why we wanted to look into the issues of how much tax revenue might be lost.
I think Representative Dunkey has Green Lake in his district. I don't know if there's resorts on Green Lake.
It's pretty much all gone, and now there's private homes that can be rented out.
Yeah, they used to say Green Lake was as pure as Lake Geneva or more.
Green Lake, Mr. Chair, Green
right
Lake still is one of the most clear lakes in the state. In fact, the last major ice palace that was built in St. Paul a few years ago, the ice was carved from Green Lake in Candia County and hauled down here to build it. Your lakes weren't clean enough down here, Representative Lapinia.
Representative Dunkey, you said one of the clearest in the United States. I was trying to give you worldwide recognition.
Okay.
No, seriously, I think it's compared to Lake Geneva.
Mr. Chair?
We have... did somebody have a question or quick comment?
Mr. Chair, just very briefly. My name is John Edmond. I'm director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. This bill is nothing that we actually initiated, but we are supportive of the concept. And the reason being is because in the 8 years that I've been director, the issue of vacation home rental has been growing. There's just more and more questions about it. We have more and more properties throughout the state that are listing themselves on the internet, on our website, offering up services to consumers. And so then there's questions about what are the expectations of consumers that are then renting these things. We're not asking questions about the individual that rents it for a week here or there, but it's people that are making a business on it, and becomes sort of a fairness issue, where you have some that are collecting taxes for the state as a whole, that are marketing themselves as a tourism business, and some of them that are also marketing themselves as a tourism business that are not subject to the same rules and regulations that everyone else is. And this is an issue, too, that has been growing throughout the country. We've been wondering what other states are doing about it, how it's defined. We don't have any answers. It's just something that when we were asked to take a look at it, we said, yeah, this is something that has been addressed by my industry and consumers. There's a lot of questions. I don't know the answers, but we're willing to take a look at it.
And
yeah, Michelle, I was just going to say the same thing. This is what it is. It's the license the businesses that pay taxes and are living, following the laws. Some people are taking advantage of the situation and not paying taxes and not being licensed. So that's, I was just going to say the same thing that you're doing.
Mr.
Chair, I can't let Representative Junkie's comments go by because actually the last ice palace was built from ice blocks taken out of Lake Stalen with the help of one of the representatives sitting at this table, having spent many nights down there with a chainsaw, a pole, and a sled.
Mr. Chair.
That wouldn't happen to be Representative Mahoney, but...
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, my comments were the last major ice castle. Oh, no, one that was actually built for the anniversary date, the 100-year anniversary or whatever it was. That was 10 times bigger than the one you built the other day.
We do have some other bills on the agenda, so I guess the chair was guilty of opening up the opportunity to advertise for Green Lake. So got us into that competition between Wilmer, Green Lake, in London and St. Paul. Any further discussion on the Saylor Amendments and the Senate File 3158, the first engrossment be recommended to pass in place from the General Register? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you. And we go now to, is Representative Weinstein still? Yeah, there he is. And this is a leader division report. Representative Leader.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 3725, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, we'll do the first part of the motion, the division report. So all those in favor of adopting the division report signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Leader, now on the bill.
I move the First Committee Engrossment of House File 3725 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Weinstein on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I hope Representative Junkie doesn't feel bad for House File 3725. thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this legislation deals with a very important transit corridor in our region. Two corridors, actually, I-35W South and Cedar. And it's a bill to authorize policy to match a federal grant for the purposes of doing congestion pricing, transit improvements, technology, and telecommuting along these two corridors, which impact a large segment of the city of Minneapolis and the South Metro. We have constituents in Minneapolis, Richfield, Bloomington, Burnsville, Eagan, Apple Valley, and maybe Lakeville that will be assisted by this project. And it's very important when we look at the transit needs of the region that this corridor be included. I-35W heading south from Minneapolis has the highest number of automobile riders, as well as the potential for the highest number of, or one of the top two corridors for transit in the region. And right now we just have some bus service that runs on the shoulders, and this will really significantly improve that service, expand it, and make it much more user-friendly. So I think to talk more about this bill and the UPA project, it's called the Urban Partnership Agreement. The Urban Partnership Program is a federal program in which very competitive among different regions, and we were one of five regions selected for this. We are needing to get this bill done by May, early May, May 12th, I believe, which is a deadline that the federal government has asked us to meet in no uncertain terms. The state of New York had the highest grant under the Urban Partnership Agreement. They were not able to act in a timely manner, and they've lost now, I think, several hundred million dollars. So this is important to move along, and the federal match is $133 million. We're putting in, as a state, $49 million, and the finance piece of this has been taken care of. So this is just the policy to implement that piece. I'm going to call on Mr. Bernie Arsenault from MnDOT to explain a little bit more about the technical aspects of the Urban Partnership Agreement. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bernie Arsenault. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety and Operations for MnDOT. I think Representative Hornstein nicely covered some of the highlights of this project. We are notified last August of our success in the application for the Urban Partnership Agreement program. That is a U.S. DOT congestion mitigation initiative that focused on four T's, they call it, tolling, transit, technology, and telecommuting. And on the tolling, we were really looking at that as a congestion pricing type activity. And in fact, what we're talking about implementing on the 35W corridor is a MnPass lane very similar to what we see on 394. And that lane itself has been extremely successful in utilizing kind of this additional tool for dealing with congestion. So with our existing ITS, or Intelligent Transportation System infrastructure, we're able to add to that and develop this MnPass lane on 35W South. The centerpiece to our proposal was the use of a shoulder lane during congested periods. So during times when traffic increases out there, we utilize the full real estate of the highway using the shoulders, and in order to deal with the safety considerations of that approach, we've added lane control signals along that corridor. This will be really the first corridor nationally and, frankly, internationally that includes the congestion pricing and these lane control signals. We believe that it is really an exciting and it's going to be a real positive piece to the metro traffic and congestion issues that we have. As Representative Hornstein said, there is a significant transit component to this. There's going to be expansion of service, both with buses and with park and rides, and the BRT along Cedar Avenue will be advanced as well. In addition, one of the highlights of this proposal is the work that's going to be done on 2nd and Marquette in downtown Minneapolis. Right now, that tends to be a transit bottleneck. And with the work that's going to be done as a part of the UPA, we will improve by about three times the capacity for transit through the 2nd and Marquette corridors. As Representative Hornstein said, there is a requirement that we pass authorizing legislation by May 12th. And again, USDOT has indicated through their actions with the New York proposal that they're very serious about that May 12th deadline. With that, I would be available for any questions you may have.
I have a quick one. I live out where 394 is, and I'm not sure what you mean by signals. I mean, you have signals that close off when you're going in one direction or the other, depending on the rush hour traffic. What kind of signals are you talking about? This is just my own curiosity, because I perceive those as signals that allow you on or off 394.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The signals we're talking about are actual lane control signals. We'll be putting up multiple sign bridges over the 35W corridor, and we'll have changeable message signs above each of those lanes that will be able to provide information to the motorists. Somewhat similar to those X's and arrows that you see approaching the tunnel. However, we'll have...
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I was perceiving something different from
right.
your comments, and I'm so curious. I said first in the nation, and I thought, well, maybe we got one right next door. Let's see, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman. The 394 corridor has been, as I understand it, primarily positive for traffic management, but not as a profit center. Can you give me any idea of what type of positive returns there have been from that corridor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, the 394 corridor has, in terms of revenue, provided enough revenue for the operation of the corridor and all of the revenue congestion pricing components of that. And an additional, the cost roughly of operating that corridor is around $1 million, and we've been getting about $1.3 million in revenue on that corridor.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson, but I have to apologize. I got your first name was Bernie, but the last name is?
Arsenal.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This account that we're talking about, in my understanding, what Representative Hornstein just said is that the projection is to raise $49 million, or we need to put $49 million in to match federal funds, and I'm just wondering if that's been already considered by the Ways and Means Chair and the Tax Committee, and all the budget necessary guidelines have been met as far as... Cause it sounds like we're going to the General Register. Is that right, Mr. Chair? Or we?
No, the motion is Ways and Means.
Oh, Ways and Means. Okay. But I still would like to have an address on that issue.
Hornstein or Mr. Arsenault, whichever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the match dollars have been identified for the UPA project already. They're in place through a couple of different means already through this session. So what we're doing right here today is asking for the authorizing legislation to utilize those shoulders as lanes during congested periods.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Hornstein, from a fiscal note, we're talking in fiscal year 2010, $360 million. Am I right in saying that that's what we're, our $400 million coming in, and by fiscal year 11, $900 million? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, what we have here is some projections of revenue and operating costs. What we're expecting is that in the first couple of years of this, because we're going to be constructing this in stages, that we'll have limited revenue in terms of the long term. So in the first year, we're looking at $400,000 roughly in revenue, but we're going to have about $1 million or just slightly under that of operating costs. But as we move along and as the complete corridor opens up, we anticipate the revenues to increase beyond $1 million, and they should easily cover the operating costs.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Arsenault, Representative Hornstein, how much of this money will be going to Met Council?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in the bill, it shows that the first year is a little different, but if we talk about the second year and on, MnDOT would receive up to $1 million or 75% of the revenue for its operating costs, and then beyond that, the Met Council would receive that amount. Again, so this gets a little bit complicated, but let's say that there's $1 million revenue in year two, and our operating costs are $1 million. We would get $750,000 because that's 75% of the revenue, and Met Council would receive the $250,000 beyond that. Now, if we were to receive $2 million, MnDOT would receive the first million, that counts as receive the second million. Beyond $2 million, it would be split, according to this bill, Every additional dollar, 75 cents of that dollar would go to Met Council, 25 cents of that dollar would go to MnDOT.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, Ms. Osnell, does the money then go back into the account? Does the money kind of recirculate back so we continue to utilize it for this special corridor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's right. The revenues that are generated by this corridor are intended to be used on the corridor and along the corridor.
I hope so.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, Representative Hornstein. Under this provision, then, the dynamic shoulder lane, it would really be people who have, we're paying the fee that gets to use the lane. So low-income people who have to commute in the Twin Cities really can't take advantage of this. Do you find that a problem at all?
Oh, Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, I think there's been some study of this issue, and I'm under the impression that it hasn't been an impediment towards that end. I don't know if
just asking you philosophically from a fairness perspective and someone who is an advocate for transit, does this seem fair to perhaps half the population of a metropolitan area?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, I have looked at some studies about any adverse impacts and disadvantages or problems associated with that, and I haven't seen it. It's certainly a concern I think that one would see on when one looks at is this in fact a quote unquote Lexus lane? I think that's what you're getting at, and the evidence doesn't suggest that. This has been a significant deterrent towards the broad range of income levels using this lane and benefiting from it. But I think Mr. Arsenault might have some more specific data.
Mr. Chair and Representative, a couple of other components of our proposal or our project that we didn't talk about earlier. One is the transit incentive piece of this, and it's a new approach towards transit and trying to induce a modal shift. What we're looking at doing as a part of this project is reducing transit charges during the peak period, and that hopefully will create an incentive for folks to transfer and utilize transit as a way to commute. Secondly, the corridor also will enable multiple occupancy vehicles, HOVs, and transit to use that lane at no charge. So that's a bit of an advantage as well. So,
President Hamer, are you done?
I'm done.
Any further discussion on the leader motion then that House File 3725, the first committee of growth has recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I take it, or Mr. Osnell, I take it that just as Representative Carlson mentioned that HOV lane on 394, you can obtain the wherewithal through the state of Minnesota to use the HOV lane. Same thing here with the Department of Transportation, that will there be a reciprocal type of a deal situation where if I want to use HOV in 394, I can also use it on 35W?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct. The technology that will be used in the transponders will work on both corridors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Arsenault, will there be a higher cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we anticipate the cost to be the same as we now have on the 394 corridor, minimum of 25 cents when it's open and a maximum of $8 per trip when it's open.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
I'm just curious, Mr. Chairman, why we can't have one of those transponders to let us in the ramp on there? Because, no, I mean, the smart pass is, or the equipment is there, and still we're fumbling around getting the window open and all that stuff.
You put that in the bill?
Yeah, that in the...
Hi, Mr. Chair, it's Orange Rosen Verhard. I don't know. I mean, I think that the concern I have, Representative Earhart, is the need to do that when one leaves the building. I don't
know.
Yes, I think it's a good point.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wonder if this particular proposal has to go back to the garage to have some retooling, as another particular project might have seen how we have some issues here. More rhetorical than question.
I just have a question. I've just become more and more aware of some of the problems with the accumulation of diesel and auto exhaust and so on in terms of the air pollution. Does this have any parts that deal with alternatives, you know, to the vehicles? I mean, I'm just wondering if that's been addressed in any way, or are you looking at that for the future? Or
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I think you raised, you know, the point in terms of why I support this so strongly, as well as transit in general. This will succeed in increasing transit riders and, I believe, getting more people out of single occupancy vehicles and into transit and into carpooling. That will reduce pollution. We have some good data about, you know, very specifically how this will reduce carbon emissions. And anytime you have less people using cars and more people using transit, you're going to reduce some of the toxic chemicals that that we find in, I think, disproportionate amounts along these freeway corridors, and where we have higher numbers of kids with asthma, et cetera. And so this is, I think, a step in mitigating those impacts, and that's really one of the reasons I support it so strongly.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, and all. Representative Mariana.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I apologize. I had to step out, so we might have covered this already, but I'm wondering, just a quick question for Mr. Arsenault. My understanding is that there's $133 million in federal matching funds available here. Can you tell us what would happen to those federal funds if we did not act on this bill before us? And is there a my understanding is that there's also a deadline by which we need to act. Can you tell us what would happen if the legislature and the governor doesn't act excuse me, on the proposal here at all in regards to the federal money?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there is a deadline to have this authorizing legislation in place by May 12th. And based on the experience that we saw New York when they could not achieve that appropriate authority, the Secretary of Transportation withdrew that within a day. And so we are taking that deadline very seriously.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Mr. Arsenault, if something goes awry and we don't act, does that $133 million that we're looking to access to this corridor, does that remain available to us? Or is there some kind of a line or something that happens in terms of accessing? So what I'm getting at is how readily available and how easy would it be, or how difficult would it be for us to be able to line up for that federal match again?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that the money will go away and be redirected to other congestion mitigation initiatives. I do not believe it would be easy to get those dollars if we do not meet this deadline.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Arsenault, would it be safe to assume then that Minnesota Department of Transportation believe that it's important for us to be able to maximize federal matches for our transportation and transit designs whenever those are available? In other words, how important is it in terms of setting policy at the Department of Transportation for us to be able to align our designs with opportunities that exist at the federal government?
Sorry, I don't know.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that we have identified with the UPA an opportunity for Minnesota, and we're pursuing it diligently, and we hope that things work out and we're able to deliver this project.
Mr. Chair, members, the reason I'm asking is, because we had an unfortunate turn of events here in Minnesota a few weeks ago with the Central Corridor, which in many ways, there's parallel issues here. In that case, there were well over $400 million available that had been lined up, apparently, for matching our investments in the creation of that other transit corridor. And our fear is that, just like this one, if we were not to act proactively on this issue here, that money then goes somewhere else, some other parts of the country, and we go back to the end of the line here. And I think it's really important, Mr. Chair, members, that both the legislature and the executive branch and our Department of Transportation be consistent in terms of advocating for access to these federal funds across all corridors. And so, Mr. Arsenault and Representative Hoyce, I guess I'm a little torn. I want to do the responsible thing in terms of this bill to be able to do an important corridor, but also to access much-needed federal funds here. But at the end of the day here, it's possibly looking like we may be partially responsible in one corridor and totally unresponsible in another. So I think it's just food for thought as we proceed. I think it's important for both the executive and legislative branch to be very consistent in terms of what the desired outcomes here in terms of accessing federal funds.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Representative Mariani, for saying that. I think you're speaking for many of us.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all in favor of the motion that House File 3725, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We now go to, thank you, Representative Hornstein and Representative Conan. House File 2998, Representative Wagenius, this was in your division.
Yes, and I will move the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division report for House File 2998.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Wagenius.
I move House File 2998, First Engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Conan, if you'd care to explain the bill.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. House File 2998 allows free entrance to state parks and recreation areas for permanently and totally disabled veterans, and of course that service connected disabilities. The veterans will present a copy of their determination letter to the park attendee or the commissioner's designee for an annual permit, and that's the annual permit system that's in place now. And the fiscal note shows no impact for this bill.
Are there any questions? Representative Simon.
Yeah, I just have a question. How did this, I'm just curious about how this got here.
Oh.
Since there's no fiscal note.
Oh, why it did this?
Yeah.
Representative Conan.
I guess I can't answer that question. It's in the Finance Committee. It was sent to you. Right.
Were there fiscal notes? Any other questions? Hearing none. Representative Wagenius renews her motion for House File 2998, First Engrossment, to be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Thank you.
I think we have next for House File 3505, Representative Bingham.
Madam Chair.
No, Representative Simon.
I'll move the bill.
Okay.
Always the division. Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Tamar.
I'll move the Public Safety Finance Division report for House File 3505, First Committee Engrossment.
members all in favor of Representative Paymar's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
And then, Madam Chair, I'd move House File 3505 to the Committee on Engrossment. Be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be very brief. House File 3505 has been through two committees and has been very vetted. It prohibits creditor registrants from accessing social networking websites. And those are for the primary purpose of facilitating social interactions between two or more persons for the purpose of friendship or meeting other persons. And also that it permits persons under the age of 18. So in other words, if it's a social networking website, and it also allows 18 years or younger persons to access it as well, creditor registrants will not be allowed to do that. And already as a condition of release for these individuals, they are subject to warrantless searches or unannounced searches of their person, vehicle, and premises, and now we're extending that to computer and electronic devices capable of accessing the Internet, and that is the deal. There is no fiscal note on this because the effective date, I'm sorry, one more thing. The effective date we changed so that it would be effective August 1st, 09, so that when the Department of Public Safety sends the annual letter out to registrants, that it would include that you're prohibited from doing this. So it takes a year to notify them to do that, so that it would be able to be prosecuted by prosecutors.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Bigham spoke. There was a fiscal note requested. There was no
Oh, yeah, there's a fiscal impact.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bingham, how does one go about enforcing this patent to the law enforcement?
Representative Bingham.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, the first part of the being able to have the unannounced warrantless searches of a computer and electronic devices, that is one way. And also the industry has really stepped up its efforts to do reporting to be reporting persons, and also to, if you've ever accessed one of these, they really do a good job of asking for information and warning you on different things. So the industry itself is working with prosecutors on a lot of these issues, too.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Bingham. Is this being used someplace in the States already that you've copied this?
I'm going to have Mr. Voigt from the AG's office answer that. I believe it is, and I know that last year we passed a bill that tightened up what I've seen the How to Catch a Predator law from the show How to Catch a Predator, where it prohibited solicitation of children for sexual activity on the Internet. So this is kind of a part two of that, but I can let the Attorney General's office answer.
Mr. Voigt.
Madam Chair, my name is David Boyd. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. There are bills like this that are being introduced this year in several states across the country. The state of New Jersey, the last time I checked, the only state that I'm aware has passed a similar measure has been the state of New Jersey, which is a little broader than this one. For some of their sex offenders, they have prohibited Internet use altogether. For convicted sex offenders who have been placed on probation or on parole, many of them are now prohibited from Internet use or certain types of Internet use as conditions of probation or parole. This would make it a new crime if they entered or used one of these specific social networking websites.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, to testify, is there any concern from the AG's office as far as constitutional challenges to taking away someone's... I mean, I understand because they've been convicted and so forth and so on, but it seems like they... 9 times out of 10, they'll get around that if they can. So I'm just concerned about from a constitutional.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Boyd.
We're not concerned about the constitutionality of the bill as written. Now, because these types of measures are new, there is not well-developed case law specifically where constitutionality has been challenged, but we view this type of restriction similar to a restriction, say, limiting a place where a sex offender can live, which many other states have enacted into law over the past several years. We haven't in Minnesota, but those laws have withstood constitutional challenges.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bingham.
Just to add on to that, I think in public safety we had policy, we had this discussion, and I think one of the more concerns was, or bigger concerns, was that if we ban the Internet completely from predators, that could not withstand the constitutional challenge, but this, as Mr. Boyd has said, is with this language, it seems to be sufficed.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Oh, Representative Duncan.
So just to be clear, this is just accessing sites with people who are minors. You can access any adult site. You can do, because it says and for a person under the age of 18 to be a member of the site. So you're looking at the Facebooks and that type of thing. You're not looking at perhaps a
monster.com
or a self-help group for predators that you may have to access in a rural area where you don't have the groups, or where, you know, or even general communication, email and other things which have become the new telephone out there. So I mean, you're and obviously on email side of it, it would be one of the concerns, because if you have a Hotmail account, certainly Hotmail allows people under 18 to sign up. So there may be some definitional things you may struggle with in the future on that, but I think your intent is what I'm trying to get at, is just Internet use by these folks with minors.
Representative Bingham.
Madam Chair and Representative Dunkey, actually it's social networking websites. It doesn't even apply to email. It's MySpace and Facebook, where they, I'm using those as examples where adults and minors are able to both have accounts on there. This wouldn't affect your monster.com for job searching purposes, where you would post information about yourself. This has nothing to do with email or those capabilities. It has everything to do with posting, having a web page on a Facebook that would post information about yourself for purposes of gaining a relationship or friendship.
With the money.
Yeah, with the money.
Are there any further questions? If not, Representative Paymar, would you care to move this along?
I'll renew my motion.
Renew your motion, thank you. All in favor?
Representative
Vicarina.
Yes, I am. You know, nobody wants to not punish people that are predators, especially. But Representative Paymar, is it still the case that like a 19-year-old going with a 16-year-old can be charged with a predatory offense, and would this apply then for the rest of their lives or whatever?
Representative Bingham.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is for Representative
Paymar.
Paymar.
Excuse me. He's going to be an expert on this.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, there are different levels of sex offenses, and your requirement to register the time period that you have to register for a sex offense varies. In that situation, it would be limited. There are some sexual predators who have to register for life, and in those situations, the AG may be able to help out here. But I think in the situation you described, I'm not sure what the time period is, but it's not a lifetime prohibition. So yes, this could be required, I believe, if the offense was between a 19-year-old and a 16-year-old.
Representative Bingham.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it does affect those that are registered for the 10 years, which is, as Representative Paymar said, there's the lifelong registration, and then there's the 10-year registration. Am I correct?
and then you would be required to be prohibited from these websites while you're registered, if that's obviously a condition of your sentence.
So, ma'am, Chair.
But you may have something to add to that.
Well, I'll just pose a question. So, you get a 19-year-old guy or gal, for that matter, who was going with a 16-year-old or 17, I don't know what the age would be, and there is, you know, an offense. And so now, whether it's 10 years or 5 years or 20 years or life, if they're caught on a computer on one of these sites, they're a violation of probation. So now, or maybe they're not, I don't know, the AG can answer me. So now, are they in jail now? You know, like those 650 beds I found out the other day for 4 DWI offenders that are plugging up our almost 8% of our jail beds now that never ever got in a car accident. It's absurd what the heck's going on here sometimes. But I'm just asking this as a legitimate question, so maybe the man from the AG's office can tell me if I'm right or wrong or interpreting this right or wrong.
Mr. Point.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar and Representative Bigham were accurate in their answers. First of all, the offense, the statutory rape offense, would apply to a person 15 years old, 15 or younger. A 16-year-old, 19-year-old wouldn't result in a crime. But a person...
How about 18-year-old, 15-year-old?
18-year-old, 15-year-old would.
If that person, bad, I guess.
If that person was convicted of the statutory rape offense, they would be required to register for a period of 10 years. And during that 10-year registration period, they would be prohibited from accessing these social networking websites. So they couldn't open a Facebook page or a MySpace page, and if they did, they could be prosecuted for that. The level of the offense would be just like a violation, other violations of the sex offender registration statute. It would be a presumptive probationary offense unless they had enough of a criminal history score to make it a prison offense.
Are there any further questions?
No.
If not,
you know, this man, Chair, members,
Representative,
you know, sometimes we get a little overzealous. And, you know, my interpretation of justice is the ability of a judge to look at each individual case and say, this is just or it isn't just. And when we put this stuff, and I'm being kind with that word, stuff, in statute, we take a judge's ability away to be just. So we have no justice left in the system. And that's what's happening with some of these laws that we've been passing recently. You know, I know that we're saying, well, we've got the least amount of people in jail and in the country and that. But that doesn't minimize the fact that our jail system has been increasing exponentially and that we're making our local jails house a lot of our offenders, many of whom shouldn't even be in jail in the first place. So, at the risk of being labeled a person who's soft on predators, sex predators, I'm probably going to vote no on this, because I just, it's getting to the point where it's getting absurd.
Representative Tamar.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. I mean, this, Representative Tamar, this isn't my bill, it's just in Bigham's bill. But, you know, the intent of the bill is really to impede and to act as a deterrent against those kinds of sex offenders, not just the 18-year-old and the 15-year-old who happen to have a relationship, but the sex offender who is really a predator, who's looking for children to entice into sexual relationships. And that's the intent behind the bill. Sometimes the net becomes broader than we intended, and I would agree with you there.
Well, right. And Madam Chair, there's nothing that allows a judge leeway in the example I just used. And the gentleman from the AG's office said, given, you know, he's back on probation, you know, and back in the system, and, you know, given some other, you know, maybe some comment or something that he may have made to someone or whatever. I mean, who knows what magnifies the penalty, you know. Okay, that's good enough.
Representative Bingham.
Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina, and I don't know that this will give you any solace in your vote, but and you and I have had many conversations about this, but there is the prosecutorial discretion too on what one would be charged with and what the end result would be as far as a plea deal between a prosecutor and a defense attorney. So that's the only other thing I would mention. But I take your concerns to heart too.
Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, Representative Paymer has renewed his motion or the motion to move House File 3505 to first committee engrossment. We recommended to pass and place on general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Madam Chair?
Representative Severson, I believe you have the division report.
Yep, Madam Chair, I move the Transportation Finance Division report for House File 3301, Second Committee Engrossment.
Members all in favor of this?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
And Madam Chair, I move House File 3301, Second Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Kalin, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Severson, for moving the bill on the committee report. House File 3301 is a bill to reform the state's design, build, fast track authority to contract for transportation projects. It is just to set the stage pretty quickly, it is not a best value bill related to the bill that Representative Hilstrom carried last year for local government contracting and public procurement, and it is also limited only to transportation projects from the State Department of Transportation. It does not deal with vertical structures that does have a design build statute, but this is only the technically limited to transportation projects. The design build statute, the design build process is, as you may know, a fast-track contracting process for urgent situations. You're probably most familiar with it for the most recent use of the authority on the 35W bridge. The first time that I believe it was used to guide the procurement of a bridge construction. Much of the bill is actually, I don't want to say technical changes, but more along the lines of administrative changes. I've been working over the course of the interim and early this session through repeated meetings and open conversations with associated general contractors, through consulting engineers, MnDOT, both legislative staff and management staff, and have recently been able to re-engage with the Department of Administration on some of their concerns. The bill that you have before you represents, I think it may be about the seventh or eighth iteration of the bill, represents significant compromise and narrowing of the bill. A couple of the key provisions in the bill are one on, I'll point you to section 2 on page 2. After putting out a request for qualifications to find if there are teams that are qualified to propose projects, and then narrowing to a group of 3 to 5 teams, then the technical review committee works with each of the small group of teams in response to a request for proposal and the qualifications there, and then ultimately grades and scores the proposal in the end. Technical review committee members currently who are part of the who are not public employees, actually, who are members of the Associated General Contractors, through a memorandum of understanding with MnDOT, are actually paid through a split agreement. And so the first sentence of the new language on page 2, line 2.7, just memorializes that in statute. I believe we've worked that out. I believe the fiscal note actually overstates the implication. I think if the existing deal is continuing, it'll be about $24,000 rather than $60,000 a year. And then the engineers wanted to make sure that we have very senior level folks on that technical review committee, people who, my training is in architecture and planning, but I'm not an architect, and certainly I know that an architect or an engineer of my age would not have the same breadth and depth of experience that someone, say Representative Anderson, who's been in the construction field for a lot longer, but an engineer of his experience would actually be able to look over the broad course of a career and be able to see the more broad implications of innovative design suggestions. There are one issue on page 4, line 4.6 and 4.7, that is added to the request for proposals language, is just making sure that that proposers' legal rights are maintained and not restricted by the request for proposal. That same, we want the technical review committee and MnDOT to be considering the proposal on its merits and on its merits alone. And we believe that that this language will do so, and I believe that the department has also agreed to that language. Further, skipping forward just a little bit to page 5, lines 5.4 to 5.13, that same concept of not limiting the ability of proposers to protest. We want to make sure that their due process rights through the administrative protest process are maintained and not restricted. And Representative Holberg authored an amendment on line 5.9, the first part of that second sentence of the paragraph, that says that unless all the proposing teams have signed off and agreed not to protest, we do want to give them 7 days after the award of the contract before the contract is actually signed, so they don't have 24 or 48 hours to have to look at all the teams and all the details, so that there's enough time for them to take a breath and decide whether a protest is necessary before executing the contract. And I believe that that language, the second part of that new paragraph E, is actually agreed to as well. Lastly, before I get to the to I think what is the point of contention in the bill, is a piece that's included in Section 1 but also then in Section 7, and that is communication about to the legislature and the public about the cost estimates of the project, and also one of the things that was a frustration for those of us in the legislature and on the Transportation Committee through the 35W process was not understanding why the stipulated fee that goes to losing teams, why that was increased. We found out a lot of things through the public and through the media, and I think a lot of us felt like we could increase the open communication with the department, especially in these fast-tracked and more emergent situations, that we can take a collaborative approach there. And I certainly don't want to, I know that Representative Severson and I and other members of the Transportation Committee, including Chair Leader especially, are very sensitive to not wanting to micromanage MnDOT. And I believe that this bill steers away from that approach, that it really just takes care of some administrative issues related to the design build contract, but the notification is really to make sure I think sometimes when Representative Severson and I share the same frustration about communication, I think we can start to say, well, you know, maybe there's something we have to look at here. And a lot of us felt that frustration across the aisle. I think the department as a whole is doing a much better job of it, and I think that the language that we have here in Section 1 specifically will increase that open communication and make sure that at least the chairs of the Transportation Committee are notified in due time of why design build is chosen as opposed to low bid, the initial cost estimate, the sort of timing for releasing the request for proposals, and of course that stipulated fee to losers, and I think to the losing teams. So that's, I think, the least controversial portions of the bill. There is one item remaining in controversy, Madam Chair, and that is on page 4, section 6, the new language in paragraph B. Excuse me. Design build differs from traditional low bid contracting process in that under a low bid contracting process, the design is completed by the department or the client, and then it's published very, very clearly in the request for proposal. Then, knowing that the design is so clearly delineated, the lowest responsive bidder who can build that project according to the request for proposal gets the bid. Under design build, to fast track a project, I think while the interest in this bill was sparked by the 35W bridge rebuild, the goal as a whole is for the bill to make sure that the issues that have arisen out of that project and other potential problems don't happen again. And so I want to make sure that the committee understands that the bill is a proactive, forward-looking bill and not reactive, but I think it's easy for us to understand the 35W bridge, since it's the highest profile and highest pressure project that has used design build. In that case, the design had to be done very quickly. And so there had to be innovation and innovative responses to the specific problems and challenges. So the proposing teams are both the designers and the builders. And the design process is tweaked as the construction process proceeds. We want to allow for some innovation, both in terms of time and design. And so we don't necessarily take the low bid, but we also don't want to write a blank check to MnDOT. I think we want to have some reasonable controls here, and I'm sure a lot of you heard some questions from your constituents about the price differentials in the 35W process. After starting at a cap of 110% of the lowest responsive bid, saying that you couldn't award the contract to any bid more than 10% above the lowest responsive proposal, we then moved to 115%, and finally what you see here is a significant compromise of 120%. Further, that cap would not apply to any project less than $25,000, or $25 million, excuse me. So we didn't want it to be an issue of a million here or there when that's a necessary range if it's a $5 million project or similar. So, Madam Chair, I believe that the department still has concerns about that price cap. I've spoken with the Department Administration just now over a concern of potential collusion between teams, that another team might agree to just be barely responsive to the request for proposals, to bring in a very low bid, and then another proposer would know that bid that could come in and they'd be at 119%. And I believe that our existing antitrust laws are such that would make such collusion illegal, and I'm willing to work with the Department of Administration over a concern that they just raised today in the hall, and the Attorney General's office, to make sure that any of those antitrust concerns are strengthened. If we need to reference those laws or even take another innovative approach, I'm willing to do so. Lastly, Madam Chair, I'd like to point out that I've repeatedly worked with MnDOT's technical and legislative staff to try to come up with if there's another way of dealing with the price issue. We've not been able to find a solution beyond a price cap at this point. And I've worked with the contractors as well, and I've invited the Department of Administration to come up with a proposal as well. I believe what you have in front of you in Section 6 represents probably the best approach to making sure that we keep design build as a tool that is necessary given our historic investment in transportation and the backlog of projects we have around the state. And I also believe that we don't want to be writing, as I said, a blank check to MnDOT. And lastly, Madam Chair, before questions, I do want to Commander Severson, Representative Severson, probably, I think you've heard me say this before, NASA has a phrase that they look at things from three perspectives. They can build things fast, they can build them safe, and they can build them cheap. But they can only do two of those things at the same time. Design build says we need to build them fast and we need to build them safe. And I think as a public, we have to make sure that we don't ignore cost, that we don't take the NASA approach, but we take a more reasonable approach as stewards of the budget here in Minnesota to make sure that there's a reasonable cost control in there, and I believe that this bill does it. So I feel like I might need to apologize for a lengthy explanation of the bill, Madam Chair, but it is a very technical bill, and I wanted to make sure that the committee understood all the elements and the way that we worked through them. So with that, I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Thielen, good job bringing the explanation forward here. I do have a couple of concerns, I think, with the committee here, I think need to be voiced. Is there current litigation going forward on the contract that was awarded on the I-35W bridge?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I appreciate you raising that. I'm sorry that I neglected to comment. Two of the losing contractors, two of the contractors to whom the project was not awarded, did file an administrative protest with the Office of Administrative Hearings. The office sided with MnDOT, although there were some concerns that the Office of Administrative Hearings cited about the process that I think actually are reflected pretty well in the suggestions in the bill on the process side of it. Office of Administrative Hearings decided to proceed with the award to Flatiron Manson, who is doing a fine job of constructing the bridge. It's fun to see it going up so quickly. The two taxpayers have filed a taxpayer suit separate from the contractors over the award of the project through a regular judicial process. One of the concerns I know that MnDOT has raised has been over whether they can engage in the legislative process related to that suit, and I actually have a letter that I'm happy to share. I have a few copies I'm happy to share with the whole committee if it's relevant, from their attorney, Mr. Thompson, stipulating that my clients hereby stipulate for the public record they would not attempt to introduce proposed legislation as evidence in the pending case. I've continued to try to work that out with MnDOT to make clear that I believe they are two separate issues and they can comment. Lastly, Representative Stevenson, I have tried to engage with the Attorney General's office to get some guidance here because they are MnDOT's attorney, and I think they've been reluctant to do so, I think for obvious reasons. Just to clarify the stipulation, I think this letter will satisfy those concerns. I don't know if you'd like to see it or...
Yeah, eventually I would.
Okay.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, my concerns go to the litigant issue that we're dealing with here. I think one of the things that we've done is we've put a gag on MnDOT being able to bring all the information out that would, you know, justify their position in choosing Flatiron because of the gag order that's been put on them because of this litigation. So they are not free to bring all the information out. And we've got MnDOT here who maybe we need to call up the table. But if we're going to go through with legislation, I would believe that we would want to do the best for the people of Minnesota. I think design build, the way it's currently situated, has its part in the toolbox. And if we begin to mess around with it before we have all of the facts that are legally able to come to the table and be represented, we're making a decision based on partial information. My concern is that if we push this forward, it goes through, that we handcuff MnDOT from a procedure that has been successful in the past based on a kind of an emotional response. I understand that there was a much higher cost to the Flatiron, but I think there are circumstances that dictated around why that happened that need to be vetted and need to be considered as this legislation goes forward. My concern is that if we push this legislation forward, we pass this legislation as we get out of session here, the court case is mitigated this summer or this fall, the judge could take into consideration that
there was credibility to the case that was brought against MnDOT on this based on the legislation that passed. I don't know if that makes sense, but we could prejudice that case by taking action before the case has been resolved. And maybe we could ask MnDOT, if that'd be all right, Madam Chair, to step up.
I believe we have one other question, and then we can have someone from MnDOT step up very, very briefly, because we are running over. Representative Anderson, I believe you had a question.
Well, Madam Chair, mine was basically to have the Department of Administration come forward, so I guess either one of the departments to come forward would be, because it was brought, they were both brought up, and that's my concern.
Is there a specific question for MnDOT that one of the members has?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would like to ask MnDOT, basically, are they able to give all of the information that they think would vindicate their position at a committee hearing in order to justify their choosing of the winner of the bid? Because if that's not the case, because if there is something that they are restricted from saying in committee that would be in regards to this case, we as the committee are making a decision and restraining the hands of MnDOT without getting the full information. So I think we need to know that in the committee.
Representative Kalin, you had a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I think your concern goes sort of to the heart of what one of the most difficult issues has been. I'm kind of wanting to flesh this out and be very clear about that separation. The legislation that we have for you, the enactment date, is a forward-looking enactment date. It's not retroactive. I'll state again for the record that while my initial interest in the process was sparked by most of the communication concerns over the 35W process, my desire is to resolve the issues related to the legislature, not related to the internal process for going forward, and my position, I believe the legislature's position should be neutral on pending litigation. I believe the bill is, and I'm stating again for the record that I am neutral on litigation. I hope that this committee is, and I hope that the legislature is. I don't know if Representative Simon might be able to comment further on that posturing, or if it's better to ask Department of Administration to elucidate and cement that. I'm seeing Representative Simon shake his head. So.
If there is someone here from Department of Transportation to address directly Representative Stevenson's question, and very briefly, please. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. And I will try to be as brief as I possibly can, but some very serious issues have been raised here, and we would not be here looking at this bill if there were not accusations and a lawsuit to the effect that the department did wrong things when it awarded the contract on the 35W bridge contract. And if you look at the legislation, I could go through the legislation and point out for you the portions of it that about which there is discussion and dispute in the litigation. And there are two things in this bill that we feel that we absolutely cannot agree to, and one of them is the central issue in the litigation, and it has to do with the question of whether or not the Commissioner of Transportation and the Technical Review Committee properly exercised discretion in determining whether the proposers on the project were responsive. And there is an amendment in this bill that addresses the issue of responsiveness and attempts to limit the discretion of the department, which we think is wrong on two counts. One, it goes directly against the principles of best value contracting, and two, it addresses the central issue in the litigation that's before the Ramsey County District Court and now scheduled for trial in November. The other issue that really concerns us here is the issue of the price cap, which has been wrongly characterized as an attempt to make sure the department doesn't have an open checkbook. We never had an open checkbook. We had a project estimate of $200 million to $250 million on this project, and the contractor that we selected came in under the top of that amount. You could say that that contractor came in under our estimate. Our top estimate was $250 million. The winning contractor had a price of $234 million. The next contractor down the list was at almost $220 million. So there's no real issue here. This is a manufactured issue to try to get at the department's choice in this case. And I think it's been very difficult for us to address this issue because, rightly so, committees don't want to hear about contract disputes and litigation. They want to hear about the subject of the legislation or the bill. But were it not for our choice in this case and the issue of the litigation, we would probably not be here with this bill. There are probably seven specific items of change in this bill, and we have actually worked with Representative Kalin and agreed to four or five of them. And they are process issues. A lot of the complaints about MnDOT's contracting process are process issues. But putting a price cap on the department's ability to select the contractor addresses no process issue. Price caps have nothing to do with process, nothing to do with the composition of the technical review committee, nothing to do with whether we make our evaluations and our scoring materials public, nothing to do with the discretion of the commissioner in determining who is responsive. All that does is serve to limit competition. And in cases of major river crossings where we are seeking a best value response and we're putting out a request for proposals and we have no plans developed and we're soliciting ideas, time-saving ideas, money-saving ideas from contractors, we must be able to select the contractor that provides the best long-term proposal for the state. This is not low bid. No one wants it to be low bid because when you pick low bid, you're telling the contractor what you want right down to the last bolt. And in this case, no one's gotten anywhere near bolts yet. We're buying ideas and something that will work for the future. And in the contract we selected on 35W, we got all of that and more. And so I think that while we are more than willing to continue working with Representative Kalin, and I would have to say he has been very generous in his time with us. I've been very happy to deal with Representative Kalin. It's just unfortunate there are two issues that we simply cannot agree on here. We have a history of using the design-build process in Minnesota that's been very satisfactory. We've done six contracts before this in the last 7 years that have received nothing but accolades from the public and from, I think, the contractors. 494 was a good project, the Highway 52 in Rochester. We've had good projects, and I think that it's a mistake on the basis of concerns, most of which we believe are unfounded on one project, to make a major change in this best value contracting law.
Thank you. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kalin. I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm not sure, I'm no expert in this area, I'm not sure if all the details of the bill are accurate, but I do think that there were some legitimate concerns over the process, and I know I received many emails from people wondering why we picked the project that we did, and I understand that we don't have all the details, and it's not just about the lowest price and the lowest time, but I do think that there are certainly some questionable issues. So I think the part of the bill that I like is looking at the new formula for the score and the adjusted score. I like that part. I think that the design process, based on what happened with the bridge proposal, I think it may need some tweaking, and I do think there were some legitimate concerns. Now, I'm not saying MnDOT did anything wrong because they were working within the current law. I'm glad you're bringing this forward because I think it is something that needs to be addressed, and I appreciate your diligence in working on this. Maybe it's not perfect yet, but it is an issue, and it is something that is after the criticism of what happened. It is definitely something that is we need to look into, and so thank you for going forward with it.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you. First, to MnDOT, I have two questions or comments, but
You mentioned three times that this was affecting best value contracting, and I was under the assumption MnDOT was not using best value, but this was about design build. Can you clarify that? You mentioned it three times when you were talking that it's going to affect your best value bidding practice, which we had discussions on not too long ago, and you, MnDOT, assured me that you were not using the best value type things. You were using design build.
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, it is a best value process to the extent that it is not low bid, and it goes through a process to select what is the best value contract, which is a combination of a technical score that grades all of the proposals and the price. It is very different from the other best value process that the legislature enacted in 2007 for all other state agencies. It is much, much more specific and detailed, and from the beginning it has imposed on MnDOT many requirements, including advance notice to the legislature and an annual report, and other additional requirements that are not imposed on other agencies. And we have always thought those were good requirements and that they made the process work. But it, to the extent that it is not low bid, it is best value, but it is very different from the process used by other agencies.
Okay, and Madam Chair,
Representative,
I don't know who's best to answer this. Perhaps Representative Simon, who's paying attention over there. I think he's the only, I'm trying to look, the only attorney that came back in there or is sitting around. It's been alluded that if this this bill passes, somehow will prejudice an ongoing case. You know, the effective date is for a bill passage and forward. I guess I would assume, and I'm not an attorney, that in a court case, you work with the facts that were in place the day of the offense or the day of question, which would be the day that the award was let. That's what people are suing on, and the statutes in place on that date would be relevant, I would assume. I can't imagine a court saying, well, now we're going to look at new statutes that weren't even in place. I can't believe that prejudices a case that's already there. And I know, Ms. Parker, you're an attorney too, so I would hope to get an answer maybe from Representative Simon. I know he had his hand up for another question too. Because that's really, I think everyone likes this bill, but Representative Severson and others and MnDOT have alluded that this will somehow prejudice the case going forward, and I guess I just don't see that in a court of law, that would even enter into the debate, because this is not statutes that was in place at that time and pertaining to that lawsuit.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Junkie, that's the reason I had my hand raised, was to comment on that. And Representative Kalin had alluded to that. I think you're absolutely right, Representative Junkie, and there are two reasons I say that. First, because it's not retroactive. Second, because there's a rule of evidence that would prohibit in a trial dragging in this kind of thing, a subsequent law change, a subsequent remedial measure, as it's called. So I don't think, unless anyone else has a different view, I'd like to hear it. I don't think this would affect the lawsuit whatsoever. It may have arose out of the issues that are part of the lawsuit, but I don't see this affecting the lawsuit or prejudicing it in any way. As long as I have the floor.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. I was just wondering, you mentioned the scorecard earlier, Ms. Parker, and I was just talking here with Representative Pepin, and we were both interested in seeing that. And I don't serve on the Transportation Committee. Maybe other members have seen that. Is there an actual scorecard, maybe a blank version that you could make available? Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that would be very helpful to those of us who haven't heard this testimony in other committees.
Ms. Park, apparently,
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, there is a, what is being passed around is a summary of the technical evaluations that were done of all of these proposers, and I have given this to many people. I believe I passed it out in the Transportation Committee as well when we discussed this bill. There is no problem with MnDOT telling you why they chose the contractor they did. The reasons were, when you look at the sheet, you can see it's fairly apparent, and the names of the people who were on the technical review committee who actually did the technical scoring of all of the proposals submitted by the contractors are down the left-hand side of the page, you can see that they were, even though each reviewer privately scored the project and they had no discussion about their scores until after each had finished the scoring, you can see that they all selected the same contractor as the best technical score, and they all identified the same contractor as the contractor with the lowest scores. And I would just like to say that this reflects contractors' scores on this particular project. This is not a reflection of any contractor's general reputation or ability. This was simply their response to our particular proposal at that particular time in history. And four of these reviewers were MnDOT employees. One was from the city of Minneapolis, which had not yet given municipal consent on the project. One was actually a member of AGC, and you can see how consistent the scoring was. And I can explain to you why.
Representative Caitlin, did you have to that point?
I did, Madam Chair. I just want to remind the committee that that I think it's probably most productive to talk about the issues of the legislation before us rather than I think that the rather than getting into too much detail on the on a specific project, I know that, as I said, it's easiest for us to understand and to talk about the 35W bridge process. And I think the score sheet is an example, you know, helps us sort of get us wrap our brains around. I think, as you said, Representative Simon, it is a very difficult process to understand all of it. I may be in the high 90s now rather than in terms of understanding, but I still have more homework to do. But I'd like to focus on the legislation, if we could.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman and members, I guess, you know, and I know that now you've been talking to people of the Department of Administration, the problem that I have with this, and I actually carried one of the original best value bills before 2007, so I guess you must have picked it from them, is that I am concerned that the cap gets us too low bid, starts to get us too low bid again. I'm also concerned that some of the strong restrictions on how you decide what a responsive proposal is means that particularly for, and you know, I'm kind of concerned that we're looking at the highest, we're doing this for the highest value, the highest cost project. Because the highest cost projects then become, of course, the major projects. So they're the most important projects that we do. And I'm afraid that the more you tighten things up, the more you get rid of any ability for innovative design. For example, if you have to make your bid requirements so tight so that you'll be, so that it will be easier to put people into that non-responsive one, you'll get rid of the ability to get innovative design. Now, my problem, and I will point out, of course, the 35W bridge is in my district. Part of my running route under it was part of my running route. It will be continue to be when it's redone. But the in a sense, my only complaint was that I thought that the quickness of it gave us a more conservative design than we would have otherwise. And if you were going really concerned about further restricting what you would look at in terms of those designs, you know, it would be even worse. And particularly when we're looking at a set of other bridges, you know, maybe not as important as that one, but as important to the communities, I'm really afraid that we'll get into the kind of micromanaging of this will get us into worse designs and worse things. And I do think, you know, I don't know about the effect on litigation. Judges have an awful lot of discretion in what they do, and I actually would be concerned that a law being passed that says that this should be changed implies that there was something wrong with what was done. So you know, so but the ability, you know, I'm just I know the people that I have a lot of respect for in the Department of Administration have concerns about this. They kind of don't specifically overdo they don't do, DOT has a lot of discretion on its own, although administration has some oversight and does manage the process. And I am concerned about what their perspective, you know, you can say it's only perspective, but it is looking back at a process, and I think the complaints about that process were overdone. And that's the suggestions that I've heard that could have improved that process. Well, they were going to choose a concrete bridge, they should have speculated, they should have said that that had to be a concrete bridge to start with. You know, I think that would have been there some very, very safe and very good suspension bridges throughout the world, and, you know, I think that would have been a terrible mistake to further, you know, to have further limited what they would choose, and I think that's the direction that we're going in, and I'm concerned about it for the, you know, it's obviously over for this bridge, and I'm concerned about it for the next bridges and for the unintended consequences of some of this language in here, like on the, it sounds like it's done to almost encourage more protests. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, and I'd be concerned about that, because if you then have a decision being made to make sure that from the start, that one of the most important things we do in this decision is to avoid protests, you know, again, I think that's going to get us, in many cases, a less creative decision. So, I don't know what to, you know, I don't know what to say about this. I don't have any specific amendments to this, but I do think that the concerns that have been expressed about this bill are legitimate.
Members, we have three more names on the list, so I think we'll move through those and try and move along here. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just reiterate some of the points that have been brought here are good points. I find myself strongly agreeing with Representative Kahn.
So noted.
We're interested.
Yeah, we are. But to the issue of will it's prejudice, I think that is a book yet to be written. However, if we do take action here, and in the litigation outcome, it is found that MnDOT was within their purview, we have passed this legislation that binds their hands. It only accentuates the fact that we made a decision based without all of the information, and that we would have to repeal this in order to get back to the place we were before. So it just goes back to the point, I think, that we need to either lay this over or vote it down and revisit it after the case has been litigated.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm agreeing with Representative Pepin and to a degree with Representative Kahn. And for the simple reason that the department realizes, too, that it needs a little tweaking. But if we don't do anything, we're going to be faced with the existing law, and the next bridge that comes up is probably going to be the Hastings Bridge. And we're going to have the same public reaction and the same comments we hear now. I know it needs some tweaking, and actually it's been in the transportation committees. It's had pretty good hearings. And you could just see the little comment we had here. A little bit of knowledge is dangerous. There are only two things that are wrong right now in my understanding with the bill. The two items are the composition of the technical committee. That's been addressed to some degree. I think MnDOT agrees with that. The big item is what they call the 120% spread between low bid and the successful bidder. That's the part that's not been able to be negotiated between the contractors and MnDOT. And I think they're both at loggerheads. We know how that goes. We're trying to deal with the budget with the governor. And if you got two people that aren't agreeing, we're going to go that way all the time. But I think it's unfortunate if we don't move it on and let them continue to negotiate. If it comes to the floor and it isn't negotiated, then I think we shouldn't pass it. Then we could go under existing law, and that's not the best thing, because if we do another bridge, as they did with 35W, whether it was criticizing or not, MnDOT is going to be open to the same criteria questioning, saying it was some problems. And I think they could be addressed, and I think it should be addressed, because there's a definite need. And I've not been a proponent. I don't want to give a long speech like we keep hearing, but I've not been a proponent of design build. I've bucked it all the way through. But there are times it should be used, and it's to a good degree, and there's some of these things coming up, and I think we should change have these slight changes to avoid a lot of the problems that we know are inherent with the existing law. And I'd like to just suggest that the bill keep on moving, and if it isn't squared away, don't pass it. I'll speak against it on the floor.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Kalin or Ms. Parker. I'm wondering, this score sheet is helpful because it sees the scores, but what it doesn't tell me is what the scores are based on. I'm wondering if you've got a score sheet that has what percentage of the scoring is based on MOBAD, what percentage is based on PR, what percentage is based on, you know, how length of time, just so I can, for a little bit more perspective, because I'm looking at this 91.47 bid for Flatiron, and 55.98 bid for Ames, which is a local company. And you know, if you're comparing these grades on a you know, on a typical scale in the school, it looks like Flatiron got an A and Ames got an F on this bidding process. And I'm trying to understand why there's such a huge spread on this, because I've always believed that Ames and McCrossin were very good contractors, and I don't know much about Walsh, but it just seems like a really huge spread. So I'm trying to, you know, relay this information, and if you have something that I'm sure it's probably in the statute book or something or somewhere that gives the exact details of what is used to make these scores, that would be really helpful before this perhaps comes up on the floor.
Madam Chair, Representative Peppin, we have hundreds of pages of information we could give you on the scoring, the instructions to the proposers, and summaries of the criteria for each item and what percent it was. I can give all of that to you. It's also all on our website, which is available to the public.
Okay, Representative Simon. All right. Is there any? I'm sorry.
In terms of the process here, I talked to Representative Kalin several times about this bill. In fact, we even had it scheduled before, and he personally requested it to be laid over while he was continuing to work with the department. And so I had a fair amount of comfort that had taken place and that it will continue to take place. In responding to Representative Leader's point that discussions, you know, take place between here and the board to see if some of these issues can't be resolved. And I have every confidence that will happen, because that's what's been happening.
Members, hearing no further discussion, Representative Stevenson renews his motion to move House File 3301, Second Committee Engrossment, to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. I would like to, members, also remind you that there is cake. I think perhaps the ice cream has melted, but every members and staff are all invited to join us in 454 for cake to celebrate Representative Carlson's birthday today.
Wow.
Okay. Yep. And our next our next meeting, members, our next meeting will likely be on Tuesday, and we'll send the notifications later today. Meeting adjourned.